Hello, welcome back to Back in My Play. This is episode number 20. For this episode, we're going to be talking about a whole system, the Neo Geo Pocket Color from SNK. I am Kevin Larrabee, and along with me, as always, is Joshua Hillier. Josh, how you doing?
Can you hear that?
I can hear the click wheel.
Yeah. Doesn't that sound nice?
Oh, the clicky, the eight-way click stick.
Right. Doesn't it sound like arcade-style control at home?
It sounds like something only SNK could have done on a portable.
Exactly. Well, that's my big intro this week. I wanted to surprise everyone.
Perfect. I got one, too, if you want to. We can all put our...
That sounds pretty good, too.
Yeah, this is... Well, you got the mini version. But anyways, hopefully you listened to last episode. It was a huge pleasure to interview him, but now we have him on for a regular episode. Mike Micah. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's awesome to be here and also on the eve of GDC. So it's one of these things where I'm all hyped up about games. And I'm also... Can you hear this? Those are my cursor keys because I only have an emulator to look at this stuff right now.
Nice.
Couldn't dig up my old handheld in time with all the work going on. But excited to be talking about Neo Geo Pocket. It's one of my favorite systems.
Well, we're going to get right into it. We're going to take a quick break and then talk about the amazing and incredibly interesting history of the Neo Geo Pocket Color. So please stick around and listen to this music inspired by the Neo Geo Pocket Color. Okay, we're here to talk about the history of the Neo Geo Pocket Color. We're going to be trying something a little bit different this time. I'm not just going to dump a ton of information on you. I'm going to leave some pauses for the other guests to talk about this stuff because it is really interesting and it was during a really hot time for portable gaming. So to begin, the Neo Geo Pocket Color was the successor to the Neo Geo Pocket, which was black and white and launched in Japan in 1998. The Neo Geo Pocket Color was released on March 16th in 1999 in Japan, and then August 6th, 1999 in North America. So just to give you some comparison, the actual main competitor at the time was the Game Boy Color, and that was released in October 1998 in Japan and then October 16th, 1998 in America. So automatically that had a head start. And when that was released, supposedly that's when SNK said, hey, this black and white thing is great, but if we're going to compete, we need color. So that's when the Neo Geo Pocket Color came out. The system debuted in the United States with six launch titles, with 20 promised by the end of the year, and a retail price of $69.95. Six different units, unit colors were available: camouflage blue, carbon black, crystal white, platinum blue, platinum silver, and stone blue. Later, it was also packaged in with Sonic Pocket Adventures. Now, the crazy thing about the Neo Geo Pocket Color, right off the bat, was the battery life. We talk about portables today, like the 3DS, which launched with between 3 and 5 hours, I believe, of battery life, depending on the 3D usage and the brightness, and even the PlayStation Vita that was very similar to that as well. This is 1999. Two AA batteries gave you 40 hours of gameplay.
That was really big. That was, I remember... That was what killed the Lynx. That's what killed the Game Gear because the Game Boy was able to outpace them in battery life. And everyone kept saying, even in development, that the one with the longer battery life is the one that's going to have the longer engagement times and people are going to be playing games on those longer. And so a lot of business decisions were made on battery life. And so for Neo Geo to come out with something that was just outrageous like that, you would just expected, like, okay, I guess we're all going to be making Neo Geo games.
Obviously, no backlit screen. With that being the case, it was a little bit easier on the power usage. And that was the game back then. You used not older components, but you used older technology that was not as demanding on power. And Mike, you know this. I mean, you were developing for the Game Boy Color at the time.
Yeah, it was. It really came down to pretty much by not having the screen lit, especially, you could get away with a lot. There's things in here, like for Neo Geo, that had like four DMA channels and all these things. Everything that the Neo Geo had pretty much upped the Game Boy Color and also had longer battery life, which was, I'm not a hardware guy per se, but that was mind-blowing. For instance, like on Game Boy Color, you had one DMA channel, and a DMA channel is essentially direct memory access done on hardware, where you could say, I want to copy information from this part of ROM and throw it on screen and have the hardware do that while you're doing other things. So like kind of primitive multitasking. Mm-hmm. On the Game Boy Color, we got that, and we could do things like a lot of animation, but you only had one channel. On the Neo Geo, you could have four channels of that going on at once. So all that animation and everything you saw in like Samurai Showdown and these games, there's only one way you could do that, and that's with the four DMA channels.
And not being backlit was to its advantage, because if you look at things like the Game Gear now, you know, 25 years later, and even the original model of the Game Boy Advance SP, the colors are actually getting washed out a little bit because of the way that it's lit. It should be probably even more so in the Game Gear. It's hard to find a good-looking Game Gear these days because the colors get washed out due to the age of the backlight and the screen itself.
Everything just looks kind of white and kind of weird.
It also included a CR2032, basically a watch battery, to retain backup memory and keep the clock active. One of the really big selling points for me was almost PDA-like features on the Neo Geo Pocket Color. Like, if you don't have a game installed, you can boot it up. You can look at a calendar. You can look at a horoscope. It was, at the time, something different. It was, if you think about it, one of the first, like, OS startup screens for a console next to, really, you couldn't do much on a PS1 or the Sega Saturn except play CDs until you got to the Xbox 360, because everything else you just would either play CDs or look at the memory on an Xbox, original Xbox.
Yeah.
This gave you kind of some stuff to do.
It did. And it also, it was before cell phones, right?
Mm. Right. Right. Before cell phones were really a popular thing. But yeah, PDA, I think, is the right term to use for it.
It's like, hey, what day is it? Let me just pause for a second, guys. Don't worry, we're at the bank. I'm going to look in my Neo Geo Pocket Color. I'm going to let you know what day it is. Mm-hmm, perfect. Mm-hmm. It's March 15th, 2004. Perfect. All right. Now we can get back to what we're doing.
You'd argue that you would never forget your wife and your anniversary date, basically, right?
Yeah.
The Neo Geo Pocket Color, I think, is the reason that marriages fail a lot more now than they did in the late 90s.
Yeah,
saved a lot of people.
The iOS is not as reliable. Also gave you an alarm, which I did test. It works. So if you wanted to go to sleep and set alarm for like 6:30 in the morning, it would actually wake you up in the morning. So you didn't need to have
that sounds risky.
Digital watch. Yeah, I don't know. Like again, it's you're risking your life on the Neo Geo Pocket Color alarm. And also gave you some cool things like the ability to look at world time, giving you time zones like Tokyo, Hong Kong, Bangkok, London, Rio, New York, Mexico, Hawaii. So somehow, that might come in handy. It was cool. It was cool, especially as a kid to see this stuff, see these advanced forms of, OS in a portable piece of hardware. And I wanted a Palm Pilot really bad. it did link to the Sega Dreamcast. It was a great partnership between SNK and Sega, which not only had that linking ability, but also brought some of the properties between the two consoles from the two companies. With that link, you could do cool things like unlock special characters in games through games like Capcom versus SNK 1 and 2 and King of Fighters 99 and a few other games. I think it was five games total that used this Sega Dreamcast link cable. But still, it was one of those things that it's innovative. They're trying something new before anyone else was trying to do it.
Well, it's like the old thing of pioneers get scalped. Like, it was really challenging back then to justify buying the link cable and all the hardware and everything necessary to do it. But the idea was so sound. And you look at it now, like on the eve before the Game Developers Conference, there's a lot of announcements. And a lot of them are talking about how through your smartphone or your iOS, Android, or whatever phone, you're going to be able to do almost the exact same kind of things they were doing back then with the Neo Geo Pocket with modern games. For like some of the new shooters, Call of Duty, and these sorts of things, you'll be able to grind on your, get your character all built up, and then log back into the game on your console and take that and add that and apply it to your game at home, which is things that were happening on the Neo Geo Pocket in 2000.
Yeah, this sounds way cooler than that, though.
yeah.
The fun fact, an MP3 audio player add-on that would fit into the cartridge slot was also developed, but it was never released due to the SNK purchase / closure. But again, you think about that time, 1999, 2000, when you started to have things like the Diamond Rio come out. Yeah. You know, the MP3 CD players that started showing up, the crazy hard drive CD, like hard drive players that looked like they were a CD player coming out, and MP3 was blown up. And this, again, just a sign of the times.
And didn't you tell me, I may be wrong, but I recall there being like even a wireless adapter you could import to play multiplayer games.
I saw one.
Saw one?
Yeah, I actually saw one when I was out in Japan. And there is a wireless adapter, but it was used for, I think, only one game or maybe two games, and only released in Japan, obviously. And unfortunately, it was not something that I could put a value on to purchase. But
where did it plug in?
I think it just plugged into the top
the EXT.
Yeah, the EXT port on the top. But okay, I gotta guess it killed the batteries pretty fast.
Huh.
So you maybe only get 20 hours.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you only get 24
hours.
You can
only play Metal Slug for a full day instead of like a whole weekend.
I swear I remember. We'll talk about this later. But so the big thing that was kind of the last nail in the coffin for the Neo Geo Pocket Color. First off, it wasn't selling great overall. It sold about 2 million units, but the SNK was eventually purchased by another company called Aruz, and then the remaining stock of the Neo Geo Pocket Color was bought back and repackaged into bundles that were later re-released in the United States in 2002 and 2003, and sent to other companies and countries in Asia like China, where the portable was still doing well. Another interesting fact, a couple games that never were officially released in the U.S. were part of these console plus six game bundles that just came with instructions. And again, kind of kicking yourself because I remember seeing these consoles with the six games selling for so cheap, like $40, $50 online back in, again, 2003, 2004, even when they're just getting rid of the last of them. But Facili and Last Blade, which are now, to get in English, very expensive and very hard to find. Facili, I believe, is going at, you know, $100 to $200 for just the cart in on eBay for the English version. And the repackage, like, you can get Facili cheap, but it's going to be in Japanese. And again, Last Blade, which is another one of the awesome franchises that we saw on the MVS and the AES that made its way over to the Neo Geo Pocket Color. Bummer.
Yeah.
Total. But, you know, I mean, we're talking about you could get it for $40, like, in, you know, with a few games in 2004. I mean, just that launch price of $69.95, that is...
Well, it's like the Game Boy, you know, the Game Boy Pocket before that, and the Game Boy Color, I believe, was at the most $80.
Right. Yeah, $79.99 if I remember.
Okay.
I think that's exactly right. And so just that, you know, lack of a barrier to entry. I just really wish we had something like that today. That's not, you know, like $100, really strange looking weed, like that red and black weed, not that, you know, but it's something that's like really cheap, but actually has quality games on it.
Let me ask you guys, did you ever remember seeing a TV ad for the Neo Geo Pocket Color ever?
No. I don't think I've ever seen one.
Okay.
Yeah, did one exist in the United States?
I mean, I have seen it. There is one on YouTube. I'll try to link to it in the show notes. But even I think the print ads that were in magazines like your Game Pros, your EGMs, and things like that. I guess that we just didn't see them enough. I don't know if they put enough money into the advertising, but you could see in these ads. Like I'm looking at one right now. The games look beautiful. The consoles look super cool. And again, in terms of the branding that you have behind it, like getting Namco games on it, getting Metal Slug, getting SNK Fighters was a really good way to push the system. But I guess it is one of those things where anyone that went up against Nintendo more or less got knocked back down.
Yeah, and you wouldn't find games like Metal Slug on any other system really at the time. They weren't even on like until much later on any consoles. So so the fact that like King of Fighters, which you could find on Dreamcast and that sort of thing, and the way it would link up to these new versions of the games, because they would redraw them in like those little chibi style characters. That it's the same kind of gameplay, but it was a new take on the franchise. Where else were you going to find all that? Or like even Cool Cool Tune and Cool Cool Jam, I think, were the two games. Yeah. And they would link together on the Dreamcast and a Neo Geo Pocket. That was awesome.
It's one of those things where it is a damn shame. It's like the Dreamcast where you see how early it died. It's one of those things that just had a lot of potential, but somehow didn't find the market that.
And the collaborations between Japanese companies back then as well. You know, you don't see that really so much anymore. I mean, Nintendo is doing a little bit of it, but
that was like the first time I think I've ever seen it. Right? Yeah. Like I don't recall it before that.
So like SNK and Capcom, you know, certainly collaborated on a lot of things. And I even typed up a couple of examples of in their games where they kind of suck up to each other. It's pretty funny. through the characters. But then SNK and Sega were certainly working well together in terms of the Dreamcast linking and all that. So
the Sonic Pocket Adventure, which was like the best of Sonic games. And at a time when people were kind of complaining about the way Sonic was being treated on the Dreamcast, even though I thought the games are pretty good there, to go back to the original style play, like Sonic Pocket Adventure is like a love letter. So the Neo Geo Pocket like it was that hardcore gamer's box. It was that handheld that hardcore gamers wanted. And the Game Boy was a little more casual, very Nintendo. And it really divided people.
Yeah, well said.
And sadly, don't know who to blame for this. Maybe it's just licensing stuff, but not like Nintendo's doing a great job with the Virtual Console and the 3DS anyways when it comes to other portable consoles. but you will not be able to play these games on the 3DS Virtual Console. So you're more or less stuck to buying the hardware itself and the games, or going through emulation. And it's, again, these games should be revisited. They should be remembered because, again, like it was one of those things where they were at the top of their game for portable. Like I would put these games up against any, I take the top 10 games from the Neo Geo Pocket Color, put it up the top 10 games against the Game Boy Color. And I bet you could still have a pretty good debate between which are going to be, you know, more fun to play.
You're right. And you know what? With emulation, especially of Neo Geo Pocket, I don't think a lot of people out there realize none of the emulators out there actually emulate perfectly. Mm-hmm. There's all these discrepancies in the way that the graphics are represented and the frame rate and also the way things are being processed and the audio. Just right now, there is no way to experience it other than to actually have it in hand and play the real games.
Luckily, it's not that expensive, though.
So. Yep.
As of right now, and at the time of recording, I really encourage people to get out on eBay or Amazon or Craigslist, if you're in a big city, I suppose, and find one of these things, because you can definitely get one for less than $100 in pretty good shape.
And to your point earlier about being some, like, put the games up against Game Boy Color, the truth is, like, SNK was all in on this device. They put their most advanced, talented teams on this device, where on Game Boy Color, most of the games, I'd say 90% of them, were the B-team guys, or it was a really cheap effort to just try to get a game out there because they had such a large audience. SNK put it all in. Their best artists, their best musicians, everybody were making each and every one of these games for the system. You just won't get that now on a handheld system, or for like an iOS title for iPhone. You don't see anybody throwing their, like, you know, AAA team that just maybe shipped, you know, Call of Duty or say Titanfall and try to say, okay, you guys are working on a mobile game now. But at SNK, all the teams and every member believed in the device and put everything they had into it.
It shows. Totally shows.
Yeah, it really does. Musically as well, by the way, like you were saying.
Yeah, exactly. That, what was his name? Do you guys know that there was like one guy that SNK pretty much used for almost everything? Started with an H. But he was like this composer that was just so well known, and he did these incredible soundtracks on the Neo Geo Pocket, made that thing sing right from the startup low sequence, I think, too.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm getting sad. No, let's
yeah, we're just gonna cry now for 10 minutes.
Yeah, we're gonna take a
that's good radio actually.
We're gonna take a break and get some hard liquor and then come back and then remember our memories of the Neo Geo Pocket Color in the end of the millennium. So stick around, we'll be right back for that. Okay, come back with us to late 1999, perhaps early 2000, when the console wars were hot. You had the Dreamcast just coming out. You had the PlayStation 2 coming soon. Yet you're at the end of the PS1, the N64, and the Sega Saturn kind of went to sleep a little bit before that because of the Dreamcast. So we have the Neo Geo Pocket that comes out, and really, let's start with you, Mike, because I think you might have a really interesting perspective on this. We talked a little bit about it in the interview, the past episode, but when was really the first time that you got your eyes on the Neo Geo Pocket Color, and what were your initial impressions?
I remember one of our engineers coming in, he had imported it, and everybody gathered around because we were doing a lot of Game Boy Color development at the time. And we were happy with that hardware. And in comes the Neo Geo Pocket. I think it was the black and white version originally. And it blew us away. The performance and just the screen itself and even the right down to the controller, everything just screamed quality. It just felt like Neo Geo was actually making a game device that was meant to, like, pretty much like... give you the best experiences in gaming at the time. You think about the controller, like the Micro Switch controller, just as you moved it. You guys did this earlier in the show at the very beginning. That sound that it made was, you could hear the switches going on and off. It just meant you had the best possible gamepad on the market. The screen, like, even though it wasn't backlit, it was way more reflective and visible than the Game Boy Color screen. I know they came out with some little worm lights and that stuff there, but we could see the screen so much better, and the colors were the black and white shades of whatever were so much more distinguished on that screen. And it wasn't long after that, because we had got the black and white in, and I remember it felt like it was just only a month later we finally got our hands on the color unit. And because, you know, the black and white, we got in, we're like, okay, this is cool. It's not going to be the, you know, it's great that the hardware's good, but it probably won't take on the Game Boy Color. And then in comes the color unit. And if there was any thought that the quality of that device was going to be something that was going to be neck and neck with the Game Boy Color, as soon as you turn that on and you've seen the startup sequence and the built-in features and the first game, I'm trying to remember what it was we looked at, and I don't remember what the first game was. I just vividly remember some of the later ones. But it was hands down like a million times better than the Game Boy Color experience. And we knew just by watching it, like there's things you do when you develop games, you could tell what's underneath the hood. And there were things that were going on in those games that we knew the Game Boy Color would never do. And so we're just anxious to get our hands on the development hardware. And that's where everything kind of fell apart. We just assumed, because this thing was awesome, the games were awesome on it, that everybody we were working with on Game Boy Color was planning to create a portfolio of Neo Geo Pocket Color games. And that wasn't the case. It was a hard time trying to get anybody even interested in talking about the potential for the Neo Geo Pocket. I think from the very beginning, people just assumed it was just, it didn't have a chance against the Game Boy Color. And it was a real shame. We made so many proposals, so many prototypes. We fought to get the hardware in so we could even just show people the kind of stuff we could do. And none of that led to any work or development for games on the platform. And it was kind of a shame because we were desperate to do it.
Where were you working at the time, Mike?
It was a company called Digital Eclipse, and if some of the classic game fans here would probably recognize it because our brand, we did a lot of the original emulation for PlayStation and PC mm-hmm. and all that. Mm-hmm. And at the time, we were the number one developer for Game Boy Color. We were developing probably 20 to 25 games a year for Game Boy Color. And we had a large team. We had a whole large studio full of teams and multiple studios. And we were just cranking away because that market was so huge. And we were willing to take nearly half the company and redirect them towards Neo Geo Pocket. And we just needed to find the right publishing partner to do that with. And that's where it all fell apart. We made some demos. I remember we made a multiplayer demo of a game that we were kind of playing around with, and we were trying to develop it on Game Boy Color. And it was kind of a Lunar Lander game. And it was multiplayer, and you're trying to do Capture the Flag and Lunar Landers and all this stuff. And we just had a great time prototyping it on the Neo Geo Pocket, and the multiplayer was flawless. It was great. We tried to get the multiplayer working on Game Boy Color before that and just could not get it to work correctly. And on Neo Geo Pocket, it was really simple. And we shopped that around and nobody was interested. It was a shame.
It seems like nobody published on the platform except for SNK. And ADT produced some games too.
Yeah, exactly. It made me think that maybe SNK wasn't really playing nice with a lot of these guys. I wasn't privy to what the royalty split would be and like the manufacturing charges and those sorts of things. We were just kind of like privy to our part of it, which is how much would it cost for us to make the game. So every time we would talk to somebody, and I'm trying to remember who is the most who's most interested. And I think maybe Activision was the one that toyed with it the longest. We had done a lot of work with Activision, and we would make bold claims. We made a game called Tarzan in which it was color only.
I looked at that on YouTube. Man, that game is beautiful. Oh my god.
Oh, thanks. that was a really fun one to do, and that uses DMA to make that animation happen.
Wow.
And Activision, when we said we wanted to do color only on that game, they fought us because no other game was color only at the time. The only other one that was color only hadn't been released yet, and it was Clax that we had done.
Wow.
And so they didn't believe it. They said, if we go color only, we will not have a market for this because the Game Boy Color versus the old Game Boy, we don't yet know what that market looks like. Mm-hmm. So we fought and fought, and finally they let it happen, but we would lose a huge amount of revenue if it didn't go right. And we were right, and it sold really well. And so Activision, they were used to us making these like really risky decisions and then just kind of backing it up over time. And so when it came to the Neo Geo Pocket, I felt like we were really close to getting them to sign board to do at least one. And I think it stalled when they started to talk to SNK. And I didn't have the insight there, but there's something definitely going amiss on the business side.
Nothing. Maybe SNK was only working well with Japanese publishers.
That's probably the reality. Their U.S. office was very small.
Yeah, and so just in terms of, you know, it's much more of a global industry now than it was then.
Yep.
In terms of publishing.
My conspiracy theory would be more that Nintendo was saying, hey, you know, if you're going to be publishing for the Neo Geo Pocket Color, guess what? We're going to kind of tighten things up if you want to publish things on the Game Boy Color. I mean, I'm just saying that's what they did when we were going against Sega. Back in the late 80s, early 90s. So that was just something that popped in my head. I don't know. Just speculating.
You think Yamuchi was strong-arming them a little bit?
Why not?
That's what he was good at.
Yeah.
He was like,
yeah.
He was a one-man mafia that would put fear in everybody else. And when he retired, I think that softened Nintendo. But that's something he would have done. I can see that.
So, Josh, what was your first look at the system? Did you see an ad? Did you walk into a store and see it? You know, how did you get a heads up that this thing was out there?
I was really well plugged in at this point and was reading magazines and reading a little bit of information on the internet about video games.
So, oh, you're on AOL? AOL, yeah, keyword Neo Geo Pocket Color?
Yeah, did a little search, a little keyword search. Nice. I queried and found some information. But yeah, I certainly knew what was happening, and I still thought this was something that was like not even real because of its small ad campaign. And I remember actually seeing them in stores eventually because, I was getting a Dreamcast on day one, and there was some connectivity between the two systems. And I had a buddy who had one, and so I would play his, but I never actually bought one myself because I did not have a lot of money back then. And so over time, he had the Card Fighters Clash game that I think everyone had at some point in time. And he had one of the Metal Slug games and the tennis game, Pocket Color Tennis. And I really liked Metal Slug, and I'm a big Metal Slug fanboy in general. So I just remember thinking, this is so awesome to be able to play Metal Slug just like on the go. Because like Mike was saying a minute ago, that was a game that, yes, it's been ported a lot now, when there's like Metal Slug Anthology that came out in the mid-2000s and things like that, but it was not a game you saw all the time back then. So to have this like kind of weird, unique version of the game where you have like a pineapple gun and things like that,
yeah,
I was just in love with it, absolutely in love with it. But at the same time, I mean, and perhaps this is how you end up only selling 2 million units, I never bought one. So as much as I liked it, because I just saw that there wasn't going to be a lot of software support for it. And yeah. I just didn't, when you realize that there's only going to be 10 or so games and no one else, besides that one guy has one, it's just not a very valuable proposition when you could buy a couple of extra Dreamcast games instead, which is what I did.
It also had that problem where like the really good games were always sold out because there wasn't huge volume of them. So if somebody walked into the store, they would always see like, here's the Pocket Color and here's like, this like weird maze game or whatever. But they didn't see Metal Slug and they didn't see those other games on the shelf most of the time. Mm.
That's a really good point. And I remember, in terms of like shelf space,
they kept them really behind the glass, behind the counter at GameStop. Yeah. It was still EB Games at the time.
Yes, I remember.
you had to have like seen a review of the game or seen an ad of it to know that it was out there to say, hey, do you have, whatever, SNK.
Dark Arms.
Yeah. I don't think anyone bought Dark Arms, but.
I'm going to talk about that game later, by the way.
Oh, it's a cool game.
It's a good game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Kevin, what about you?
Well, I'm going to be brief because I've talked about this story. I think it was with Mike, but the Neo Geo Pocket Color, as soon as I saw it, I said, this beats the crap out of the Game Boy Color. And it was probably the next week because my Saturdays were spent with my dad being a divorced parent's child. So, my dad would basically, where do you want to go? I would love to go to the Liberty Tree Mall, go to EB Games and see what they got, and then walked in and saw the Neo Geo Pocket Color and was blown away because they had Sonic the Hedgehog Pocket Adventure bundled and a display unit for you to check it out. And as someone that grew up with the Game Gear and the Game Gear that came with Sonic 2 and then played the much improved Triple Trouble, seeing Sonic Pocket Adventure on a very small console on a beautiful screen actually play like Sonic the Hedgehog that I would play on a Sega Genesis was just mind-blowing. And I was at the time not super jazzed up for the Game Boy Color. I think I bought one at launch and I bought a couple games, but it was like, it's funny to hear you say this now, Mike, because I thought not a lot of the games were taking advantage of the console. Like, they didn't look that much better. They just kind of looked like, Game Boy games with color. And
it was an incremental upgrade.
The best game the best looking game on it was Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
Like when it came out, and I was like, mm-hmm. I can play this on an NES or something. So, this looked like a much bigger leap, harder push of innovation. So I was sold, and I ended up getting that bundle with Sonic the Hedgehog and brought it home. And I was impressed. I was not disappointed when I started actually putting some time into it. And I think the whole time I owned it, I probably changed the battery 3 times because it did last for 40 hours, and it just was great. I eventually picked up Match of the Millennium for it. As soon as that came out, I believe I traded in one of my Dreamcast games to pick that up, because across, literally at the mall that I went to, across the way from that EB Games was the arcade, and they had those two machines for fighting games with the huge, I think they were probably rear projection screens at the time. They were like 50-inch screens with Marvel versus Capcom, and I think the other one had Marvel versus Street Fighter. And I liked fighting games, but seeing these games with these super moves, like these moves that weren't impossible to pull off, they weren't fatalities, which I had forever. I've always had problems doing fatalities, but seeing these moves that if I just hit buttons enough, I could do a super, and seeing a game like Match of the Millennium where I could look at the back of the box and I can see that they have a super meter and I can see them doing their supers in it immediately, I needed to have this game because it just made sense. So I picked that up. And again, that was the moment where I knew, wow, this console feels amazing. Like you feel the initial version, like the first version of the console, and even the revision, it feels perfect in your hands. And it's not like American hands, like bigger hands.
Yeah.
It feels good. And the from the stick to the buttons, the responsiveness of the buttons to, it just looked really cool. I fell in love with it immediately.
Ergonomics. Let me talk about that for a second, because you just brought that up. And that was something that used to always stand out to me, because Game Boy was still going with the thin sort of vertical design back then.
It wasn't
this was
bad.
Before the GBA came out, you know, and sort of had a design which was much more similar to what you see with the Neo Geo Pocket. But yeah, it still, though, wasn't very comfortable if you had larger hands, you know, a thin, vertically oriented device like that. You want something more horizontal where you have two grips with a screen in the middle. And so I thought that was pretty forward thinking, honestly. And like even today, as an old man as I am, this feels great.
It feels like it fits perfectly in your hands. Like there's places for your like you can like your middle fingers
you
like
can grip.
Fit perfectly on the bottom of it. Like it's
right. And neither the Vita nor the 3DS do this well.
Dude, the 3DS, I hate holding the 3DS.
I know. Yeah. I have a grip for it, I never buy those things, but I have to have one for it.
When you're playing the Neo Geo Pocket, there's never a moment where you feel like the ergonomics have actually betrayed you in any of the games you're playing. Like everything, your fingers just naturally go exactly where they need to go. There's no discomfort in it or anything like that. That was always the case from when it came out until now. Like when one of the guys in the office, he had his in here, I was sitting there like kind of checking out again, because I'm like, I want to remember the size of the screen and all that stuff. And it's just like, it just felt like coming home to that device. It was just, to even this day, it still works fantastic.
Just the transition from a D-pad, which, you know, it was great. Like, it was the gold standard of, you know, directional controls. But then feeling the silky smooth, awesome, like the pleasure. Like, it sounds so stupid if you haven't touched one of these sticks. But just like the pleasure that you get, you know, from moving that stick around, knowing exactly what direction that you're pressing in, because over time, if you really played the crap out of your Game Boy, no matter what, that D-pad gets squishy. And it's not everyone's going to open up their Game Boy and, you know, clean the contacts on under the D-pad and things like that. But with this, like, it just felt perfect. You knew exactly what direction you were going in just by the sound of the stick itself. And like we've alluded to before, the fighting games were incredibly enjoyable. Like, you had... Like, Mike, talk about, I'm sure, like, Pac-Man was one of those things that was a big seller on there because of the cool things that they did with that.
Well, Pac-Man, I've been involved in versions of Pac-Man for home, and the worst thing that happens when you're planning to bring Pac-Man to any device is assessing the D-pad on the device. So for instance, like Xbox One's D-pad was awful. And Xbox One and the first Xbox, I should say, both of them still, the D-pad is terrible. And the PlayStation D-pad's better, but even that is kind of problematic. And the reality is Pac-Man was a four-way joystick in the arcade. It was built to be played four-way. And when you introduce diagonals, it messes up the logic of the game. So if I'm going down a hallway, I'm pushing diagonal right, like up and right, what gets priority? Is it up or is it right? You can't predict what the player was thinking when they were doing that. So you have to limit the axes to four directions or it just isn't going to work. And we've tried simulating it. We've done all this other stuff. And we've gotten pretty close to making Pac-Man play right. And if you look at the latest Pac-Man Championship Edition, they've added these little graphical flourishes. So if you're pushing more up, it shows a little grind on the top. So you know that you're going to push up or you're going to go up when you get to an opening. And also, they have to do all these things to make Pac-Man play right. On the Neo Geo Pocket, they shipped an adapter to make the joystick actually be four-way. So you could play Pac-Man perfectly. Who does that? Like, how could you convince anybody in the world to do that other than SNK to invest in that, even though it's just a little plastic disc and it locks in, to invest in that effort to make sure that Pac-Man is going to play perfectly on their system? And it made a huge difference. People who liked Pac-Man and played Pac-Man on Neo Geo Pocket, that was the definitive version of Pac-Man. And you couldn't get that on PlayStation or anything else.
Now I know why you like Crush Roller, because I opened up a brand new copy of Crush Roller today, and inside it was three of the four-way directional accessories. And it even said, write a big neon thing on outside of the wrapping, includes four-way joystick adapter for arcade play. Yeah. I'm like, man, you're not messing around. And I actually tried playing it without it, and it makes a gigantic difference.
It does. And that game is just like Pac-Man. In the arcade, it was a four-way stick, and if you tried to play any other version of it, it just wouldn't be captured correctly. Neo Geo Pocket had a solution for it. It was awesome.
So if you – this is off topic, but if you refurbish a Ms. Pac-Man machine today, do you go leaf switch or do you go four-way switch?
It depends on which brand it is. Leaf Switch is the way to go, I think.
It's hard to find them, though, man.
It's really hard to find them. You can actually, a friend of mine has made his own Leaf Switches, but it's really hard to find them. That's probably the best way to go because it actually gives you a wider range of dead space when you're changing direction. Mm-hmm. And micro switches are great, and there's ways to modify those, but ultimately they're getting harder and harder to find. Even the four-way joystick, the proper four-way joystick's hard to find. You end up getting the Street Fighter style four-way joystick, and that just doesn't make it seem right.
Man, I love looking at these old, sorry, as a motorcycles are going by my house, but I love looking at old warranty cards because you can just, again, get zone into the time frame of when this stuff came out. And, you know, having it ask you about, where did you hear about this? From a friend, TV, movie theater, newspaper, radio, internet, SNK website, magazine ad, game review. I'm sorry, guys, you didn't put ads in any of these.
Yeah, exactly.
Was there not a space where randomly stumbled upon it one day?
Well, it's cool. They knew their audience. They said, what other game systems do you own? SNK CD-ROM, SNK cartridge. So I guess it wasn't Neo Geo CD or Neo Geo AES, but SNK mm-hmm. cartridge, Sega Dreamcast, PlayStation, N64, Game Boy, Game Boy Color, other. Man, it was really cool. Opening up, I wanted to wait to do this for the show, but opening up a brand new Neo Geo Pocket game, which you can still get tons of them. There's still plenty of them out there, and you can get them for regular price. I recommend you do that. NeoStore.com is where I got it.
So cool.
Man, any...
What is NeoStore.com? Is that someone who has collected a lot of this stuff and is selling it? Or is that actually affiliated with SNK?
No, NeoStore.com, they actually buy back MVS cartridges and AES games. And they just have, if you go to their store, there's a section called Pocket Games, and they sell, I think they have 40 Neo Geo Pocket games on there. A bunch of them are brand new and they're cheap. You can get, games complete inbox, Metal Slug. I bought a copy of Metal Slug First Mission in the, we didn't even talk about this, the awesome cases. We didn't get the snap cases over here. Those were in Europe and Japan, but or I guess even Japan didn't really have a lot of them, only for a couple of games, but they made these awesome hard snap cases, kind of like a Sega Genesis game case, and you can get Metal Slug First Mission with this snap case in English for $29.99, brand new.
That's awesome.
So that's definitely, if you want to get into this and you want to open up some brand new games, that's where to go. And I also got Neo Turf Masters, brand new and sealed, there for $30. So
I'm looking at it right now, and yeah, I'm getting pretty pumped up.
Start ordering some. And Crush Roller was only $24.
Yep.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah,
it's still there, Mike.
You know what? I might buy it just to have more of those little four-way discs to
put on. Totally should. Games.
In the, does it really come with three, Kevin?
Yeah.
Why three, I wonder? Oh, that's fine.
In case you lose them, man, and it gives you like a little instruction card on how to install them. But even the games, the regular boxes were, again, just way nicer than what you got on the Game Boy Color and even the Game Gear, because it kind of like opened up. So it was almost a cardboard case that had a little slot for you to put in the cart itself with a separate pocket for instructions. And it was, they were well built. Like they were hard cardboard instead of, you know, it was really easy to crush Game Boy. I mean, Mike, you probably have a bunch of boxed Game Boy stuff, like just the, you know, how easy it is to crush those things.
If you don't open a Game Boy game over the years, that shrink wrap just starts to just suck the box in on itself. And like, have you seen those where the boxes start to just crush under their own weight of their shrink wrap? It's bizarre. So it's like, yeah, like those boxes were so cheap. And I have like really nice ones, like what's that, the Ninja 5-0 and those games.
Wow.
Shrink wrap, all brand new, but then like the shrink wrap just starts to eventually just crush the box. So I've had to slit open the shrink wrap on some of them just to give them a little breathing room. But you're right, on Neo Geo, when you saw Neo Geo Pocket, especially before it got into the discount bins or whatever, it just felt like that was the masterclass gaming system. That was the Criterion version of portable gaming. And Game Boy Color just felt like, you know, the $7.99 Blu-ray bin or whatever, because there's so much. It was just a huge volume of stuff, and you had to sift through and find the diamonds in the rough. Neo Geo Pocket, every game was a diamond. It was awesome. The one thing I kind of want to get at was the lineage of the teams responsible for those games, because I don't know if people really realize, but that, I mean, you see it when you look at a Neo Geo game. There's a distinct look. The pixel art is incredible. They were one of the last vestiges of like pure, beautiful pixel art, right? Like you'd see Metal Slug, that animation and just every pixel was handcrafted in that game. That came from a team that started way back at IREM, and if you recall, like the visual look and everything of like R-Type 2, a lot of those people worked on R-Type 2, and from that point forward on all these games, there was a game called In the Hunt that was from IREM. It was a submarine underwater game, and that art style, if you look at the game now, if you bring up a screenshot and you see it, you'd almost think that was Metal Slug if you weren't paying attention to it being underwater. All the explosions, everything else, it's that signature style of these teams. They were like at IREM, then they formed, I think, Nazca, and they worked with Neo Geo. And there's a game called Gun Force 2 that was an arcade game. Are you guys familiar with that one?
No.
It's a game that was not very well known, but it was by the same team that made Metal Slug. And if you go back and you watch videos of this game or you get a chance to try it, you will see that this game is essentially the prototype for Metal Slug. And the visual style, that kind of gradient gray pixel where they can make metal
crap.
Really good metal. This is the team. They did Air Duel, which was this awesome shooter that looks just like you'd expect from Neo Geo and that sort of thing. These guys were master craftsmen with pixel art. And they were thrown on the Neo Geo Pocket. And if you really look at the text specs between the systems of Game Boy Color and Neo Geo Pocket, the visuals, the graphics themselves, there's not very much difference to them. They're almost the same technically. They can almost output the same things. It was the fact that these guys were incredible artists and craftsmen of screen art and animation. They made that Neo Geo Pocket look like a system that was generations ahead of the Game Boy Color, using almost the same kind of display hardware. That, I think, is one of the key ingredients to at least the qualitative success of Neo Geo Pocket. It's just a shame that they couldn't take that and move on to another platform, take Neo Geo even further into a Game Boy Advance competitor. Because those guys, if they could have kept all them together and making games beyond this platform, who knows what they would have come up with. They were incredible.
Yeah, Mike, I talk about this periodically on the show. And it's just a real shame to me that we lost pixel art over the years and the push for 3D polygonal graphics.
You know, and you're right that this was some of the last really great pixel art we saw, aside from what's happening now in the indie scene a little bit. But, you know, something that's like being funded on a big level by a major publisher, you know? I hate wondering what we could have seen, like what you were just saying, throughout the 2000s and where we might be today, if there had been sort of a split path in which, yes, we push for the 3D polygonal stuff, but we also looked for some really good pixel art and 2D sprite-based stuff like that. But alas, it was like not to be.
You're right. It's because it's partly our faults. We were so taken up by 3D and PlayStation and all stuff that we did not buy those games, right? Like, if you look at Rayman that came out on the Atari Jaguar and then the PlayStation, that's a great example of incredible pixel art. And it did really well. And if you look now, like, it's come full circle. It went into 3D because they felt they had to do that because they would lose the audience if they tried to stick to that handcrafted, beautiful 2D artwork. And now they've come full circle. Their latest games have been these 2D masterpieces that I feel the Nazca guys would have been able to do the same thing. Like, if they were able to go down that path and create, imagine a Metal Slug with the 2D engine and technology of Rayman right now. It would be amazing.
Yeah. Well, I'll be right back, guys.
Yeah. You know, just a couple other things that I wanted to hit on briefly. One, you know, we lost the 2D pixel art because we needed more games like Apocalypse on the PS1. Being able to get Hollywood style, Hollywood quality acting in visuals in games. So I understand the sacrifice of the 2D stuff. But seriously, talking about some of the teams that were on there, when you had a game briefly after launching in the U.S. At the caliber of Sonic the Hedgehog Pocket Adventure, it was to me, and I think to many other people, a real system seller. They did not put the B team on there. You know, Yuji Naka did a lot of the work, and it was Sonic Team collaborating with SNK on that game. And Mike, like you said, like, I literally wrote this down when playing it. It is a best of the 16-bit Genesis games with some different names and some remixed music. It plays exactly like it should. And on top of that, it just it is super fast. It doesn't slow down. It's great.
And you can imagine what's going through the mind of the team, right? Like, if you're Yuji Naka, who's been working on these bigger budget titles, and you get the opportunity to go back to your like foundational years and revisit that, you might have these things in your mind with the things you should have and would have done. And also, that was probably some of the best times of your career. I think for a lot of these guys, the Neo Geo Pocket was an outlet to recapture that kind of experience developing those kinds of games, and a hope that they could continue making these games. If they could make it a success, they would have a market for that stuff. I think a lot of these guys were hoping this was the way to keep pixel art and classic 2D style gameplay alive. And we were just, as consumers, we neglected it, and we should have probably been a little bit wiser to it. If we could have turned this into a success, we've seen probably a lot more 2D games.
Unfortunately, in 2000, I was only 14. I got my first job literally the day I turned 14, working at a grocery store, and I had limited funds that could go to video games with the Sega Dreamcast at the time as well. I was not able to purchase a lot of the Neo Geo Pocket games, sadly. I think the only two that I ever owned when it was released was Sonic and Match of the Millennium. And I'm going to blame this partially on reviews on IGN because I started on like N64.com, if anyone remembers that, which was like kind of where, it's where like IGN started from, and then they started doing other platforms, but they did not really review these games very favorably, and they would always mention things like being really short, and as someone that was a you know, conscious consumer when it came to buying games, like, I needed to make sure I got some money's worth out of it. I avoided buying other games for it and eventually traded it through some online service to someone else for a copy of Crazy Taxi, House of the Dead 2, and a Leica.
Not a bad trade, honestly, though.
No, not really.
You were able to rebuy this later. This is some pretty hot games.
Yeah. So, but again, it was one of those things. I wish I didn't read those reviews, and I just kind of went in the store and like looked like now. I won't talk about this now. I'll talk about it in the next segment. But I'm really sad that I missed out on some of these games at that time.
Yeah, I remember sitting in the office when we'd see some of these reviews, because we were always, the minute the games were available, we would either import them or we'd be waiting for them to arrive on the truck at the local GameStop, essentially, or Funko, or was at the time. And we would read these reviews and just complain about the review. I remember we had an engineer, Daryl Starr, who refused to look at some of the reviews for Neo Geo Pocket, because every single time he'd read a review on there, he would contest it, and he would play the game and realize like they were trying to measure these games against console games, which was totally unfair to do. And now when you think about portable games, a lot of people won't talk about game length so much anymore or any of this stuff. But at the time, that was such an important thing that a lot of people are just casually looking at reviews are like, oh, the game's short? I'm not going to, like, every minute's worth X amount of money to me, sort of mentality. And that's thankfully gone now for mobile games and that sort of thing. But that was really big back then. And you look at Sonic, one of the best Sonic games, 2D games made available on Neo Geo Pocket, and people would not buy it because they were told it was short. Mm-hmm. And it's like you're missing out on one of the best versions of Sonic just because of that.
Yeah, or even it was the case with Metal Slug. They said it was like 20 minutes long. And
the arcade game's shorter, isn't it? I always thought it was. It seemed I could get through the arcade game.
It's about 25, 30.
Is it? Okay.
I played through it a couple weeks ago.
Okay, well then, you know. But it's like, so it's the same experience as the arcade, and you're going to complain about it. It's insane.
And it is one of those things where they made, you guys have both said this, but they made such great decisions when it came to bringing those games, porting them from the NVS and AES to the Neo Geo Pocket Color. You look at games like Metal Slug, especially Metal Slug 2, that actually has like really clear sounding voices for the pickups. And Neo Turf Masters, which it is Neo Turf Masters. It has all the cutscenes. It has all the characters. It has not all the courses, but it is there. And man, the like we'll talk about it later. But the fighters, amazing.
You know
what?
For young game developers working on the Game Boy Color, where the hardware was very similar, it was like a textbook for us. It was like, you look at the Neo Geo Pocket games, the teams that made those games and their decisions they made, and it was like learning from a professor. And you go into each game afterwards and learn how, okay, I'm going to do my audio like this. I'm going to downsample to this level so it's clearer. There's so much to learn from just observing these games that they put out there. Metal Slug is the best example. There's, you know, the palette's very limited, but they made these really distinguished color choices to help separate the background plane from the foreground plane. And what groups of color do you put together for that? And how you created your palette for pickups versus bullets. And
parallax scrolling.
Yeah, like the device itself had two layers of parallax scrolling made up of like 8x8 tiles like an arcade game would have.
Crazy.
And they separated those layers. They could use the same colors in each layer, but they were smart enough to separate those layers and group palettes in a certain way that just made it visually appealing, and it limited the color per plane, but it still looked amazing compared to any other like game on Game Boy Color. So we would start borrowing from all that stuff. We would later do a game, I probably talked about it in the last podcast, but would later try an attempt to port the entirety of Dragon's Lair, the arcade game, to Game Boy Color and include full motion video and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of the lessons we learned from just what they were doing on Neo Geo Pocket, we had to apply to palletizing full screen animation and stuff later on, which was awesome.
Man, okay.
What a task, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, it was gargantuan, but we did it.
One of the last games that I played on the Game Boy Color was Star Wars Episode I Racer. And it had the cutscenes at the beginning. Which kind of blew me away, but that's just a crazy anecdote. And for people that do subscribe to Retro Gamer, is that what it's called? Retro Game? I have the copyright.
I think it's Retro Gamer.
Yeah, Retro Gamer. Yeah. I just got my issue today, and at the very last, the big thing that they're going to be talking about for next month's issue is Resident Evil Gaiden, like we talked about on the interview with Mike. So that is going to be must read. Super cool stuff. Okay, so that was a lot. We're going to take a quick break, and the way that we're setting up this next segment is it's going to go all over the place. We're not focusing on one game. We're just going to say, yeah, man, I played this, and I couldn't believe this. So it is going to be different, but it is we're going to do it. So stick around. We'll be right back. Okay, so now we're back, and believe it or not, it's 2014, and the Neo Geo Pocket is super cheap. You can get 10 packs of games on eBay for like $40, brand new, and we have been playing a ton of this stuff. If you've been following me on Twitter, and also from talking to Mike on the last episode, I went a little nuts when it came to picking stuff up and buying consoles. I did not, however, buy the Mega Man Battle game, which goes for like $200 and was only released in Japan. But if you've ever played the Mega Man fighting game from Capcom, it is very similar to that. So we're just going to go around in a circle. I'm going to ask you guys to bring up a game and talk about it. And, you know, we'll kind of have just a discussion about this stuff, because I think we'll try to limit it to like two rounds and see how we're doing for time. Does that sound fair?
Round one.
Okay. Josh, why don't you take round one? What was one game that you've been playing these last couple weeks, and what stood out to you?
I want to make sure that we talk about Dark Arms, so I'll start with that. That game was one I did not play when it first came out, so I just got to play it recently, and I really like it. I think Dark Arms is a very cool game, and I read online and tried to figure out if there was ever any talk of a sequel, and there was not, apparently. So have you guys played Dark Arms as well?
Yes. I did. I played a lot in the day.
Oh, okay. So you actually have warm, fond memories. And Kevin, you didn't play it, right? You said that you had Match of the Millennium and the Sonic game.
No, but I did pick it up, and I couldn't figure out how to save for about an hour, so that was awesome.
Yeah, but like the game itself, though, for those who aren't familiar with it, it has it's sort of, you know, has like a spooky, campy horror vibe, and it's top down, like Link to the Past, you know, those sorts of Zelda style games. But you're walking around with a handgun that you can later evolve into other things by feeding the gun, which is just so cool. You can feed different items in the game to make them turn into like mini shotguns and things like that. And a lot of exploration, a lot of finding keys to unlock areas and things like that. And then going back to talk to the Grim Reaper-esque character. And I just always eat stuff like that up, like Zombies Ate My Neighbors and anything that's sort of campy horror. So the music is great. It's exactly what you would expect out of like sort of a mono 16-bit soundtrack for a horror game. And the main character sort of reminds me a little bit of Ash from Evil Dead.
Yeah.
Except, you know, he doesn't have a chainsaw or anything like that. But it's really cool. I'm looking at my notes. That part was all straight from the brain, but this part's from my notes. Apparently I wrote, if Castlevania had been a top-down game with guns, I don't know. Does that make sense, guys?
Yeah. It does make sense, because I think a lot of people misunderstood the game. Like, again, there was hardly any marketing, and just by looking at it and just like the like small descriptions you'd see in like the import sites and everything like that, it sounded like it was one of those like hardcore RPGs. But in fact, it's more of an action game. It's more like Castlevania, and I think that tricked a lot of people.
Very light RPG elements, like yep. Yeah, like what you would see in like Symphony of the Night and some Castlevania games. So I think this is honestly, it's my favorite of the Neo Geo Pocket Color games that I've played over the last couple of weeks. I've sort of fallen for this one in a pretty big way.
Awesome.
Well, it is like a, almost a Zelda 2, you know, mix up. You get to progress, and also you mentioned the ability to upgrade weapons. Collecting, it's almost like collecting, I haven't played Dark Souls but a lot, but it's like collecting souls and then being able to upgrade yourself. And just the look of it and how it was dark was something you probably didn't see that much at the time. One review from February 1st, 2000 on Amazon.com mentioned that despite the rather questionable name, Dark Arms provides a very enjoyable action RPG experience similar to, say, Zelda. Perhaps the funnest part of the game is, quote, growing and, quote, evolving your weapons. The graphics are excellent, as is the gameplay, although the game is somewhat short. Great for RPG fans, as there are very few RPGs out there for the Neo Geo Pocket Color. It was only reviewed by two people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
So it kind of shows how well it sold.
Yeah, and I also, like, I looked at game FAQs, which is a pretty scary place a lot of the time, but I was still only there last night to look, and because they have boards for individual games, and so I was looking at Dark Arms board to try to find some more insight and some things I could bring up on the show today, and there's just two discussions, and one of them received no replies, and the other one was just somebody talking about how his girlfriend gave him a Neo Geo Pocket Color for his birthday one time. So, yeah, I think that you're right, Kevin, that Dark Arms is the definition of a cult classic.
Good music, really good music, interesting mechanics. I think the recharge of the gun kind of bugged me a little bit, like having to wait for that thing to recharge as you get started
it
in the game.
It took a while, yeah.
But as you get more powerful weapons, the game becomes a lot more manageable, and you start having to make the trade-off of killing enemies and capturing enemies. So it had like that Ghostbusters like theme to it too. So it had an interesting mechanic or trade-off when it came to that too, because you could plow through enemies with some of the earlier weapons, but you would not capture the beast. You would have to actually use the net, like the net gun or whatever it was called, and capture him that way. But from just playing it these last couple weeks, that was one of those games that really impressed me. I'm like, I can't believe I never heard of it until I got it in one of those big packs of those 10 packs of games.
Yeah, and it's just sort of thrown in there with other games. You're right. You know, it deserves a little bit better than being put in there with some of the random maze or puzzle games. But so
you'd recommend it for $4?
I would recommend it for, yes, I would recommend this game for $20.
For $20? Easily.
I would pay $20 for this.
I'll sell you my copy for $20.
Will you?
Yeah.
Will you sign it?
I will. There's not a lot of room.
A Larrabee.
I'll initial it. Okay. Mike, how about you? What's one of those games, you know, revisiting the Neo Geo Pocket Color that has really stood out for you?
You know, I had very little time to kind of go back and revisit, but I'm kind of going back to the early days here because a lot of my career was spent trying to port a more grand experience down to a handheld experience. And sometimes it was good and sometimes it was really bad, maybe more times it was really bad. And one game that really stood out to me, and it's probably not the greatest in the collection or anything like that of the portfolio games, but Samurai Showdown really drove it home to me because until I hadn't played any of the other fighting games on the handheld until that was the first one I played, and that left the first impression because fighting games on handheld game systems were awful. There was no way around it. There was just no games that I felt could capture what it was like to play a fighting game. And then here comes Samurai Showdown. It felt right. The moves were remapped for the buttons correct. Like it's even though the game was kind of different because it had to be, it felt like Samurai Showdown. The pacing, the character designs were flawless. You would not be able to get like a scale down. You don't just take the sprites from Samurai Showdown and shrink them down. They recreated them to be perfect for this screen. So they had that like large head, small body style. And correct me if I'm wrong, like, you could play that one multiplayer with the link cable too, correct?
Yeah, almost all the
all
games
them, right?
on
all
the Neo
it.
Geo Pocket Color had two-player linking ability.
Yeah, because I can't think of one that didn't, and like that there was also a big selling point for this thing because they didn't sacrifice anything for the experience. I don't think anything on Game Boy ever, any fighting game on Game Boy ever really got close to the fighting games that were on Neo Geo Pocket. So Samurai Showdown, I love it because I have great memories too. I remember going over to my friend's house, who was the only guy who could afford a Neo Geo, and playing Samurai Showdown every Sunday with like probably 10 or 15 of our other friends just doing round robin tournaments, all those things going on. And it was like this out of reach game that I would never be able to play on a home system. And then I got on Neo Geo Pocket. The music, brilliant. And we could you say this for every single Neo Geo Pocket game, I think. It's pretty much the music was spot on. It just sounded better than anything you heard out of a handheld before. And then the visuals, the art team, that team we talked about before that would have gone to be Nazca and all these guys. I don't know what their voodoo was. I don't know how they decided to create approach creating the artwork the way they did it, but it was brilliant. The fact that you only have, what was it like, I think you had, there's 16... I won't go into very big details here, but there's 64 sprites you could use. There's four colors per sprite and all these limitations on how you'd be able to multiplex them. Like if you wanted to get like whites of eyes with black pupils and skin tone and maybe like two skin tone also on a similar sprite, you'd have to start layering sprites on top of each other. So a lot of people would do that, but it would start introducing flicker because you'd use up all the sprites. The art team that worked on this game, they avoided that by using very limited colors, but perfectly. I wish I could get into their heads and figure out how they pick their colors, because when you look at a screenshot of Samurai Showdown, you would assume there's more color being displayed there. But when you actually hacked it apart and looked at what was actually being used, it's probably half the kind of palette you would see in competitive games. So I Samurai Showdown to me is like one of those masterclass games from a technical level. And it was the first time that I was probably sold on the fact that you could put a fighting game on a handheld system and capture it and the experience with that.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that that's really well said. And talking about the art style as well, you know, sort of they could have approached it in a few different ways, but they approached it in let's just make it unique to the platform. So not only controls, but art style as well. So it just feels like this. It doesn't feel like just a replica. It feels enough like Samurai Showdown.
Yep.
But it has its own style. And
yeah, it's its own Samurai Showdown game. You can't really say it's a port per se. And that, I think the fact that they turned against what everybody else was doing on Game Boy, I think what you'd see on Game Boy were hundreds of developers taking some other experience and just shrinking it down to the screen and not even addressing the fact that that was the wrong thing to do.
Right.
And they identified that and they changed course and invested in creating a whole new experience, which would mean they'd have to spend more money and they would have to spend more time on making sure that this thing as a standalone product on a handheld would stand the test of time. And that was awesome.
Right. And it works for it. It really does.
Yep.
To bounce off that, I'm going to talk about another fighting game, one of the lesser known games out there, Gal's Fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you a little bit of background, they basically took the female characters from the SNK series and put them all into one game, and it's the best fighter on the console. It's in my mind, or my eyes, it is for my money, whatever. It is. Better than Match of the Millennium. I have more fun playing this game. And again, it's kind of weird. It makes sense in terms of, you know, you go to Japan, you go to Akihabara, you're going to see some weird female stuff. The female games out there are kind of weird. But having this game probably wasn't going to market well in the US because guys, you know, don't want to play as girls in games, you know. But this game... The animation, it's not only just like the graphics, but the animation of these characters are above and beyond anything else that's on the console. It looks beautiful. It is super smooth. The supers that are in it are fantastic. And this is the crazy thing that they did. the characters are actually different. They were redrawn for this game from, you know, other things like King of Fighters and Match of the Millennium. They could have just taken those sprites and then dropped them in to this game and just like kind of use the same assets, but they completely redrew them. They redid all the animations and they added in special moves and attacks. And it is a ton of fun. It is something that I found while I was out in Japan for, I think it was about $14. And it is what I played nonstop since I picked it up. It's probably the only thing that I've really played on it, except for a little bit of Sonic Pocket Adventure. But if you haven't checked this out, it goes for about $40 on eBay now. If you can find a copy, but it is a ton of fun. I really hope you guys have. I don't know if either of you guys have checked this game out.
I actually have this, and if Samurai Showdown was the first impression game I had, Gal Fighters is the probably the epitome of what they could pull off in a fighting game. The sprites are only three colors, if I recall correctly. I think that's all they ever use, but they look so clean and so clear. And the backgrounds, they put a lot more color in the backgrounds than the foreground. And that's opposite of what anybody's like logic would be. Like, you put all the color in the characters, not in the backgrounds. They did this, and it gave it a really cool look. And you'd have all those full screen effects on a handheld game, like a jet flying by and gunning people down. And
cutscenes, like they had the cutscenes in the fights.
Crazy.
Yeah,
full screen effects and all stuff going on. It's a technical showpiece, but it's also really well balanced and it's smooth and clean. It's a good game.
If anybody wants to see the game but does not want to buy it, which you should buy it, by the way, because I think it's really awesome, you can go to YouTube and just search for Gal Fighters combo video, and it's like a minute and a half long video, and it just shows how smooth the animations are.
Dude, it's nuts.
Yeah, it just shows all those like really smooth combos from different characters, and it shows some of the background stuff that you guys are talking about right now. It really sells the game. You're gonna want to buy it after you watch that video, though.
That's probably why I like it so much. Is it is so I like the over the top fighters. So that is probably another reason. Like, it's even one more notch above Match of the Millennium in terms of the crazy things that you can do in it, and it's a really cool game. Try to track it down, Josh.
I'm actually on eBay right now looking up a couple things we're talking about that I don't.
This is
have
the
yet.
Worst part. This is probably the number one email I get from people on, or from email or on Twitter or on whatever, is I love your show, but I also hate it because it causes me to go on eBay and buy stuff, and that's I'm sorry. Like, that's the risk you take.
Exactly. And I think that if you're listening to this, you kind of want to go on eBay and buy things. This is your excuse.
You're already at the trigger point to go onto eBay. You're just looking for an excuse at this point.
There it is. This is merely an excuse, like you said. I'm going to talk about Match of the Millennium. I know it's sort of an obvious one to bring up, but I think it's a great game and deserves to be discussed anyway. And it's one that I have a lot of nostalgia for, having played it a ton way back when, as well as Card Fighters Clash, which maybe one of you guys will bring up. I'm not sure. I love the Versus games, and they were at sort of their peak of popularity in the late 90s when this came out. And it's just, this is a testament to how good fighting games are on the system, because this might not be the best fighting game on Neo Geo Pocket Color, but just that, that control stick and the 8-gate feel, you know, like, if you're not pulling off different moves or supers or whatever, it's your fault, right? Because I mean, you can feel exactly whether you've made the motion or not, and you can hear it as well with the clicks. Like, okay, if I'm doing down to forward A to throw a fireball as Ken, then I should hear three clicks, right? Or else I missed it somewhere along the line. And so, I mean, that's really replicating the arcade fighting experience in a big way. Chibi art style is so cool. I always like that. I like it in the Pocket Fighters games and the Puzzle Fighter and all that stuff. I think it's really funny as well. Like, the things that characters say to each other, there's a lot of great dialogue. Shout out to 8-4, by the way. There's also some pretty bad translations along the way. So I think you guys could have done some good work if you had helped out with this. I do want to bring up the specials and the supers, like when you actually like build up your super bar, like Akuma, for instance, the screen goes black and his whatever the writing is that comes up when you do that in any Street Fighter game, even now in like Super Street Fighter 4 Arcade Edition and things like that. It looks perfect, right? I mean, it's sort of a showstopper set piece type of scene when you pull off those moves as Akuma. So you don't really feel like you're losing a lot in playing this. And tag mode it's really fluid. Like I didn't remember any sort of slowdown as a kid. And so I was wondering if maybe there would be slowdown now when you tag people in and out, but I didn't notice any today.
Rock solid.
Yeah. And so that's pretty impressive on a handheld to be able to, you know, tag people in and out in real time as much as you want. So a great game. Oh, I want to say this as well. The Capcom and SNK sucking up to each other things. Yeah. Like Terry, for instance, tells Ken that it is an honor to meet him.
Yeah, the endings and stuff.
Yeah, it's really funny how into these companies they were. But, you know, I guess I'd rather see that than just being mean and fighting each other.
Sure.
So you guys have anything to add to this about Match of the Millennium?
26 players, 26 characters.
Yeah.
In a portable game.
That's
with all their moves. Too. Yeah, all their moves are in there.
Right.
It's crazy.
And it's not just like, well, okay, here's like 12 Street Fighter characters.
It's the obscure ones, right? It's like BB Hood and all that.
Right, right, yeah. And you know, there's some Darkstalkers people and like Sakura and, you know, it's really cool.
Dude, I love her, man. That's my character. I pick her. I usually pick her and Ken, man. I love her uppercut, her sprint uppercut thing.
Yeah, me too.
Mike.
All right. Well, you know, every generation of a console, there's always some weird game I nerd out on, and against all logic. And at the time that I had the Neo Geo Pocket, I had a chance to play an arcade game called Densha de Go, which was the train simulation. It's like Crazy Taxi, but super slow. And I got completely fascinated with that game. And then they created a version. Taito actually made the version of it for Neo Geo Pocket. And I was the only one excited to get it. Nobody even really wanted to look at it. And I obsessed over that game. The arcade game was kind of cool because you could do all this stuff in a shorter amount of time because the game could be pretty long. But the Neo Geo Pocket version of it had like an arcade mode, and they had this sort of like original mode that you would see on other systems and that sort of thing. And then they had like all the presentation or thing that the arcade game would have was kind of represented in the Neo Geo Pocket version. You sometimes have like these first person views on the tracks of the train, and it's, you know, we're going from like fighting games and from Samurai Showdown, all stuff, but like I obsessed over I probably played that. I almost was reluctant to bring it up on the podcast because I probably played that game more than any other game on Neo Geo Pocket. And even at the time, people thought I was crazy, but it's a really good version. If you like Densha de Go, the Neo Geo Pocket version was better than any of the other versions that I'd played at the time. It was portable, which was really a big deal for me because when I was flying around, I just would play that game. And also, when people were complaining about how long of an experience a lot of the games were on Neo Geo Pocket, this one was like unending. It was so long. You'd go through so much of it. And for those who don't have much background in it, it's like a realistic train simulation, and they had all the kind of like realistic routes in Japan. And I learned a lot about Japan from playing the game because when I finally went over to Tokyo, I kind of knew how to get around because I remembered Densha de Go. They're like, oh, I need to get off this train and go on this train and get over here. But I recommend that one. I know that's kind of an oddball one, but it's really fun. I got the itch to kind of go back and play it. That's why I was trying to find my Neo Geo Pocket before the podcast, because I wanted to really dive in on it and be able to talk in detail. But that would probably bore everybody to death.
No, but no, how is it?
Weird games we love.
Yeah, is it for people that do not speak or read Japanese? How easy is it if someone imported it? Because the console is region free.
Yeah, you know what? I don't speak Japanese or read it, and when I first got the game, it was kind of tough at first. A lot of it's in Japanese, but all the main menu things, if I recall correctly, they would put English underneath it. And even when I imported it, they said there was no English, but when I started playing the game, there was English all over the place. So I don't know. I remember like the missions and stuff like that, I would have a friend of mine read to me, and he would just say what I was supposed to do or whatever. But since then, I, even after I stopped playing it for a while, I would see that some websites would come up with playthroughs mm-hmm. that kind of explained everything. So there's a lot of resources online that can help people get through it. But if you're a fan of Densha Digo or just train simulations or just to see oddball games on Neo Geo Pocket, I recommend that one. And also would recommend some of the other console versions that have the full train control systems and all that stuff. Because you know how there's the Steel Battalion giant joystick? Mm-hmm. There's versions of stuff like that for trains.
For PS2, yeah.
Yeah, for PS2.
Great Game Center CX cool. episode.
Oh, they had one? Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, God. The guy was going, because you have to like break perfectly, and if you go over, you lose points.
It's, yeah, you're breaking like a mile away.
Yep.
You're like, stop. You do that all in the Neo Geo Pocket version, too.
Oh, man. If they only made like a little, mini controller that attached to the Neo Geo Pocket Color.
We would joke about that all the time because I had the other big controller for PS2 and all stuff, but and people would make fun of me for that too. But the reality is, it'd be awesome to have all those little levers and stuff like that attached to your Neo Geo Pocket.
That's one of the weird things. Like I saw that out there. It's pretty expensive, but the fascination with games in Japan. Or for Japanese gamers that are games that are jobs. Like there's one for like even Giant Bomb had one on a couple weeks ago for Coco Curry, or no, it wasn't Coco Curry. It was one of the other like fast food kind of joints where you can play through that. And there's on Dreamcast, if you haven't played it, Tokyo Bus Simulator.
Yep.
Is super, super, like, it's just weird. There's lots of those train games and bus games and like horse racing games. Like, I don't know.
Like Derby Stallion and all those things. But like, honestly, I never saw myself as being like a train simulator guy. And it was a friend of mine at Next Generation Game Magazine when I was working there who brought it in and he was obsessed about it. And then I got obsessed about it. And then next thing you know, like the whole office was obsessed with it. And that's one of my guilty pleasure games for sure.
Yeah. Even go to the Club Segas. There's arcade versions of that game now. Of the train game. So it is crazy. I'm going to finish up with, man, this is tough because obviously we're not going to talk about every game. Like we could do this for hours. But I'm going to talk about Metal Slug 2 because Metal Slug Second Mission, because getting into the MVS stuff and playing a lot of Metal Slug over the last, 2 months or so, going and playing Metal Slug First Mission is nice. Like it feels like Metal Slug. It looks like Metal Slug. You have a lot of the same items. It's good. But then you go into Metal Slug 2 Second Mission. There's a nice bump in visuals. And I think the big thing that was missing for me in the first game was the voices when you do pick up items, because it's crazy. Like you hear them say like rocket launcher and like all that stuff. It is what I believe is a key component to the atmosphere of those games is picking things up like machine gun and all that stuff, grenade launcher. I think that's a big part. And also we're talking off the air, but the crazy things they do visually, like when you're in vehicles, which is not just the Metal Slug, but also the airplanes in there. And when you use the airplane and you're firing out of the airplane, there's actually lighting effects on the plane itself, which is just, I'm like, man, I can't believe they're doing this. Like it's probably just a simple change in the sprite. But for me playing it on a portable system, and it's still just a lot of fun. You get a lot of the same kind of, a lot of the same, not emotions, but the same, enjoyable components out of the portable version of the game. And it's just a really great transition. And it's in those 10 packs of get, like, you can get, like I said, 10 pack of these games for $40. And it's one of those games in there. I highly recommend picking up. It is a ton of fun.
Kevin. Go ahead. You go first, Mike.
I was going to say it's like they put out Metal Slug First Mission or whatever, and they're like, okay, we could have done better, and then just like not too long after, like, this is what we meant to put out. And the lighting effects you're talking about and all this stuff, it's the sum of its parts, all these little effects and nuances that come from the arcade game and even stuff that wasn't even in the arcade game. You see it pulled together in one package that it's just so well crafted. Every moment, every little pixel, and what's like when you're talking about the jet when it shoots and you get that light on the front. I remember seeing that in Earthworm Jim and thinking that was brilliant, but that's really costly in production times because like those are extra frames that you can't afford to have in the ROM, and they found a way to fit it all in, and it's today it's one of my favorite Neo Geo Pocket games. It's the one I actually played right before we talked because I figured we're going to be talking about it, and it feels great now as it did back then.
Holds up, still better than Contra. I'm sticking with
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it's way better than Contra.
Yeah. It's
come on.
Well, there's people out there that play, you know, NES Contra's the best, man. Konami Code.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, those people just haven't gone back and played these two games side by side is why they say that.
Well, you need to go get like even just get one of those Metal Slug compilations packs on PS2 or whatever and play some of this stuff. These games are just they hold up forever.
They really do. I got so excited when you brought this up as your last game, Kevin, that I accidentally hung up on the call. on our Skype conversation that we're having. That's how much I like Metal Slug, and that's all a result of back in my play. So no matter what comes out of the show in the end, it's made me a lifelong Metal Slug guy.
Now, did you guys notice in the box there's like this little indented, little elongated thing next to where the cart goes that's like an insert for something? Do you know what was supposed to go there at all?
No.
This has been a mystery to me and a lot of people. You see where the cart is inside the box.
Like on the left side, there's an opening to put stuff in.
Yeah, do you know what that's for? It looks like it's a little rectangular thing that like you would insert some little tchotchke or something into. Do you see that?
I don't know. I think that's where the four slot things were when I opened up my crush roller.
You know what? Maybe that's what it is, but like I'm gonna take a picture of the one I have, and it's been a long mystery. I had someone tell me that they used to have a little spent bullet. That like a shell that they would put in it, but they would take them out when they did the importing. And I just want to confirm if that's what actually was supposed to go there.
Oh, of the Metal Slug?
Yeah.
Oh, hold on.
Oh, that's so cool.
Wait, I have it.
I've always wanted that to be the truth, and then I want to go find a Metal Slug that can fit in there.
Yeah, that's so cool.
I guess it's the European version of Metal Slug First Mission. Okay. And it's the hard case. And it has... you're right. There's a little extra slot on the bottom of where the cart would go, but I don't know if there would be something in there.
There's something that looks like the size of like a AA battery.
Yeah.
That's the mystery. And a lot of people haven't been able to talk about it. And there's been a couple. Actually, I had two people tell me that it was a spent bullet casing that would, but wow. They had to pull them out. And so I just wanted to, I'm just curious.
I was
maybe
just
you
hoping...
had the magic one. You had the golden slug.
Yeah, I just didn't know if they were going to make like, you know, those like super big cartridges like they did for the Genesis to put in extra ROM chips. Maybe we could get Doom playing on the Neo Geo Pocket Color.
That would have
this is one of the few places where it's not, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one that's on my list of games that I want to talk about. But we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with some like news discussion stuff for a couple minutes, and then we're going to wrap it all up. So hopefully you haven't maxed out your credit card. It's literally impossible with this system unless you have a really, small limit. But stick around. We'll be right back for some more stuff. Final segment. We have a lot of cool stuff to talk about, but
I have a question I wanted to ask Mike real quick before we really get into it.
Yeah, man, go for it.
Okay, so we were just talking about Doom a minute ago and how Neo Geo Pocket Color was one of the few places where you could not play some port of Doom. And I know that Mike has worked on a ton of different games over the years. So, Mike, have you ever worked on a Doom port?
You know, we've never released one, but we did work on a prototype. It was for Activision at the time for the Game Boy Advance. It would eventually get a version of it. And we worked a little bit with this guy, Chris Hecker, to bring over a small version. But I wish I worked on some Doom. Doom's one of my favorite games, hands down.
Yeah, it's brilliant stuff.
On my 14-hour flight to Tokyo, I read Masters of Doom.
Oh, I really want to read this.
It is awesome. Like,
it's a really good book.
I was I went through Audible, so I guess I'd listened to it, but I literally did not stop listening to it. I started maybe 30 minutes into the flight, listened to it the whole flight, and it is an amazing story of what happened at id Software. Oh my God.
It really captures their personalities really well, too. Like, there's that one part where they're talking about John Carmack and his cat and how one day the cat doesn't yeah. show up anymore because the cat basically wasn't optimal to his lifestyle.
Well, the cat was peeing on the couch.
Yeah.
That was
so
the problem.
I wonder what happened to the cat. It kind of scared everybody else.
Yeah. I guess the story was he literally, like, dropped the cat off at a shelter because it was peeing on a new leather couch that he bought for the office.
Yeah.
So he, like, this is the office cat. And he just brought the cat to a shelter, dropped him off, came in, like, nothing happened, and people were like, where's that, you know, whatever the cat's name is.
Yeah.
It's like, he's not coming in anymore. He retired. So that's kind of weird. And again, just talking about the ports, the interesting situations that they ran into trying to port the game to the Super Nintendo. Nintendo came to them and asked them to do a port of Doom after, you know, a couple years after they were trying to get Super Mario Brothers 3 onto the PC. And they, like, recreated the whole first level of Super Mario Brothers 3 perfectly on the PC. And this is kind of when the Johns were getting together before leaving the company that they were with at the time to start id. So if you haven't read it, Masters of Doom, it is it's actually really cheap. I think it's like $12 on Amazon now to get the book. But the audiobook is fantastic, and the only probably negative about it is just it might be a little dated because they only go up to it's like even before Doom 3 comes out. I think it's like 2004 or something like that. It came out in 2005, so but it's still I loved it. Loved every second of it. It was great.
It's really good to see. It's a good study of how game development can a game developer studio and everything that can be born out of just weird friendships and interests in certain things, but and also founded around a technology base, because Carmack was basically the technology of the whole studio forever.
Yeah.
And his innovations in scrolling that they were doing for what was the original game that they were doing that was a 2D scroller?
Commander Keen.
Yeah. Commander Keen, which that was born from the Super Mario Brothers 3 technology, right? Mm-hmm. And so they were able to wrap around a screen on a PC, which at the time was
impossible.
Unheard of.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so just seeing all those little steps, they did Hover Tank, which then became like mm-hmm. ultimately Wolfenstein. And Wolfenstein was like the first test on Super Nintendo with 3D ray casting. Mm-hmm. And that didn't use the FX chip that Doom would later use and all kind of stuff. It's just an awesome thing to see how the technology would drive the creativity of the company when a lot of other companies, it's the creativity that drives the technology.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, it's a sign of the times. Seven or eight person team made Doom.
Yeah, one of the like it defined a whole new industry, really. Like a new version of the game industry was born from Doom. I was there that night when they released it and trying to get it off
the FTP server or whatever.
Yeah, like it eventually ended up at University of Michigan, and we were fighting for time on that. And I was waiting all night to be able to have my slot. And so I was one of the guys that next morning had Doom on my PC, and like all I could do was call everybody I knew to come on over and check it out. It was
awesome. Oh man, that's cool.
And the Atari Jaguar version of Doom's really good too, by the way.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's probably the best version I've played.
Shareware, man. Like, imagine companies today. Imagine Activision, like, giving away a third of Call of Duty, or giving away like two free maps to people, and saying, "Hey, if you want the rest, it's $60."
Well, that's kind of the free to play model.
If you think about it now, like Electronic Arts with The Simpsons Tapped Out, it's a free game, but ultimately your spend is going to be like your lifetime value, whatever, is going to be around $60 probably on average. It's just the new way of doing things, but then it really started back then with shareware.
I like the idea of shareware better. I mean, I got to play games that I shouldn't have been able to purchase, like on, like I subscribed to PC Gamer. And you would get that disc in the mail with the magazine with, you know, all these great demos. And I got to play through like Shadow Warrior, which at the time I was nowhere near old enough to buy. But you could break the PC Gamer thing by signing up for two free issues every 2 months. And you would change your name just a little bit. And they would keep sending you issues, and you would also get along with that, like these letters, you must pay you for your subscription right now, but they never like came after you.
Yeah.
So it was a man, like that's why I love doing the show, because it's like cool things like that, that I would never think of.
Mm-hmm. And like in shareware, the other thing about it too, was like, they were upfront about what you were going to be doing, and free to play. It always feels a little sleazy. Like, oh, I can't play this game now because they want to like piecemeal it and try to get as much money out of me. And
I can only play 10 minutes today, and you know, I can't play. You could play the whole first 8 or 9 stages of Wolfenstein 3D or Doom. And they did the same thing with Quake. You got the whole first chapter of the game, which, you know, for a lot of people, you know, that might be enough. But it was just a really interesting story. Check it out. It's Masters of Doom. But one thing I wanted to bring up as we'll just kind of talk about some stuff. I know we got some really cool discussions in here, but I just want to say, going back to Japan and just getting back, prices have gone up substantially in Japan, at least in terms of the Akihabara area. Like the places that I used to find cheap stuff, like prices were up 20%. And it was kind of worrying me. Like I didn't buy a ton of stuff because things weren't really cheap anymore. They were getting more close to like what you would just get if you wanted to import something from eBay. And even with the shipping, it was almost even money. But
So then this is just over a few months of time?
This is over 6 months. I went in August last time.
Right.
And I thought I found some better deals, and maybe things were just kind of picked over a little bit. But some of the games, like there's this really good place, Mandrake in Nakano, and that place has pristine games, but you can sometimes, like I remember finding Super Metroid there for 600 yen. I went back this time, it was 1,000.
Wow.
Like that is a really steep increase, and I don't have anything to attribute it to. It might just be retro gaming is picking up in popularity, but just something for people to give get a heads up on before going out there. But I did come back with some really interesting games for the PC Engine. One being Outrun for the PC Engine, which is a great version of Outrun.
It's really good.
Like again, how did they do this stuff? Like this is wizardry, because the really being an 8-bit system with a little bit of, you know, extra bump, but being able to play Outrun with a really good version of the soundtrack, and really the only thing that's missing is the screeching of the wheels when you turn.
Yeah.
But I don't know, Mike, have you played that?
I did that back in the day when I had my TurboGrafx-16 or whatever. That was the only way to play Outrun. It had all the speed and everything of the arcade. And if I recall correctly, did they put out Power Drift on that platform too? I'm trying to remember. Because I vaguely remember Power Drift being on it as well, and just I couldn't believe the fact that it just moved so smoothly. And I think Thunderblade as well. Like those games that had the scaling sprites that would come at you and draw that much on screen, you couldn't do on any other system. You couldn't do it on Genesis. You couldn't do it on Super Nintendo. And TurboGrafx just pulled it off. Outrun felt right. It played right. The color palette was awesome. Because, like, you know, like some of the Genesis versions of it, even Sega's own platform, the colors always look kind of dingy. But TurboGrafx had these very vibrant colors in their version. And Yeah, it was great. That and R-Type, right? Like R-Type 1 and 2, Part Perfect. 2 or whatever it was. Perfect. They're just like these flawless Perfect versions course. Of these arcade games.
Yeah, it's from someone that's owned like 4 Outrun machines in my life, I can attest that it is really a really good version of the arcade game, and it just has that same kind of feel when you play it. And also Street Fighter Champion Chip yeah. Edition on the PC Engine, which I didn't get to play until I got home. But again, it's what? Like
yes, it's great. You had to have, was it? You had to have a Super Graphics Expander or whatever for it too, right?
No, comes. It has the extra hardware built into the card. The card is awesome. Super thick, and it comes in. I don't know why they did this, but they actually put it in a what looks like a 2-disc CD case. Like it has that yeah. that almost like you if you think Metal Gear Solid or Resident Evil 2, yeah. whatever that kind of CD case, and it is. An amazing port of the game, and I just playing it, like, can get the 6-button pads for you can, again, being Japan, I bought this game brand new off Amazon, and also a 6-button pad brand new off Amazon for a total of $40, which is just cool, like to be able to open up a That's brand awesome. New Turbo or PC Engine game, and I might try doing a video of it. I'm really busy right now, so I don't know if I'm going to do many videos for the time being, but at least go to YouTube and check out Street Fighter Championship Edition on the PC Engine. And again, in some ways, it actually has more detail than the Super Nintendo version of the game.
That's what I was going to ask. How does it compare in your mind, like, overall?
There's to the things... Super Nintendo version? The sound obviously isn't as good. It's closer mm-hmm. to like the Genesis version, but I think it sounds better than the Genesis version. And also the details in the TurboGrafx version, like if you go to Ryu's stage, mm-hmm. there's bats flying around the house in the background. Not in the Super Nintendo version. It's in the PC Engine version. Like, you would think that would be something a lot easier. I don't know. Again, I don't know how or why, but there's a really good comparison on the internet. I think if you just type in like PC Engine versus Super Nintendo Street Fighter, you'll actually get a page where it compares the Genesis, the Super Nintendo, and the PC Engine version. It shows you the differences. But the main thing is the speed and how it plays. And it plays, I'm not elite, I'm not a, you know, in a fighting tournament kind of thing, but it plays really well, like from what I can tell.
That's awesome.
So just like that's weird stuff.
That is weird stuff.
From someone that never saw that growing up. But yeah, I think Josh, you wanted to talk a little bit about PlayStation VR, which we should hear about next week, I think.
Yeah. So Mike, you're gonna be at GDC?
I will be at GDC this week.
And you're gonna get to be at that particular panel? Or is it invite only?
I am not sure, but I'm excited to see what they do with VR, because obviously Oculus Rift is, everybody thinks that's just going to be a hit, and the amount of money they've been raising for that has been phenomenal. Have you guys used Oculus Rift at all yet?
No, but that's where John Carmack is now. Just leave.
Yeah, well, see, there you go. Like John, who built an empire at id and working with Bethesda now, left and is now their CTO at Oculus. So you know something's good over there. I've been using it quite a bit here in the office, the Oculus Rift, and the kind of demos and stuff that have been coming out for it have been phenomenal. The space combat games are incredible. Roller coasters are so simple but effective. If you're going to like see the magic of Oculus Rift, ride a roller coaster with it. And if you puke on real roller coasters, you're going to puke in the office or your house. It's got that kind of one-to-one connection. And it works great with kids. My 4 and 7-year-old, they love it. They love playing games in it and everything else. So I think their generation is going to really take to this, assuming it all takes off. So you can only imagine all these big guys like Sony with what they're going to be announcing, and Microsoft and all these guys. They have something cooking, I'm sure. We're going to see some pretty innovative things. And just really quick on that note. If you remember, the Atari Jaguar tried to do VR, and they had Missile Command in 3D that started out as Missile Command VR. And if you put in a certain code, you can still play the VR version of Missile Command in there. It's like the Jaguar couldn't push two individual renderers against the eyes fast enough. But that kind of game, remembering what that was, would be awesome on the Oculus Rift now.
Yeah.
They're just a little ahead of their time.
They were ahead of their time.
Like, think about what you can do with these devices outside of just the thing that's on your head, because we've been thinking about a lot here in the office. If you have 3D cameras around the room, you put one on each side and one behind you, and you have the one in front of you, and you put this thing on your head, you can actually represent in real time the room that you're in. And these cameras are looking at you and creating you every single frame in 3D by observing the 3D space of the room. So one of the best demos that we've been kind of toying with trying to put together here is you're standing in the middle of the room, you're holding a controller, you have this thing on your head, and just by pressing a button, you pull yourself out of your own body and turn around and see yourself, and you can fly around yourself in real time.
That is awesome.
Where do you get that experience anywhere else? You can't. And like, then you get to see how big your butt is or whatever. Maybe make a version of Mr. Mosquito where you're landing on yourself and trying to get blood out of yourself.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of stuff you could do with that that you could never do in games before. My biggest worry is that a lot of people will take this technology and just port their games over and introduce a new way to play it. That's not what's going to push this. And I think that's why Carmack is there, because they will be taking the lead on probably Oculus in general will probably be taking the lead on what games should be for VR, not what you can do with what you already have. And those kind of experiences, I'm so excited to see what people come up with.
Yeah, it's the most excited I've been for an innovation in gaming since the analog stick on the N64's controller.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, seriously, I think it's going to be that big of a deal.
It will be. And the other fun thing for like retro gamers like ourselves, there's already emulators ported to it, which that sounds kind of crazy, but like one of them, you have the Super Nintendo, and you're playing like Super Nintendo on a giant screen TV that's floating in front of you. And so the best thing to play on that is Star Fox. And I'm sitting there I'm playing like Star Fox on the biggest TV I've ever had in my life. And you can look around and see things around you or whatever. And then there's been some people who've made like these really cool demos where they take like N64 Mario Kart. And they've managed to make it where you can be in the kart and look anywhere you want while you're racing.
Jeez.
And it's kind of weird and it's kind of broken, but like that's somebody just hacking something that exists. And kind of experience, I can see what Nintendo would do with something like that properly, and that sort of stuff. It's just it's so much more of an engaging way to experience a game that I'm sure there's going to be problems and there's going to be a lot of hiccups along the way, but this is the closest we've ever been to it. And
exactly.
It seems to generally work. The problems that come up, I think, with most people now is the motion sickness, which you have to be very careful about how you handle camera and stuff like that. And there's only so much you can do. It's however fast somebody moves their head is how fast they do it. And then things like people with glasses and prescription glasses, the challenge has been, do you wear your glasses with the headset? And how big is that? And does it have room for them? And that sort of thing is how comfortable is it? And there's also the notion that there's going to be prescription lenses for these things that you can get, which is just a pain. Like imagine you have to go and get like prescription VR glasses on top of like getting this like $400 thing or whatever. So there's a lot of challenges that it can probably become or be overcome with just the tenacity of somebody like Oculus Rift. So hopefully all that stuff gets kind of swept under the rug and we get past it really quick and we start seeing the games that are going to define VR, which I think are just around the corner.
And I'm with you that I think that Oculus Rift is probably, you know, just from Carmack alone, is probably going to be the better thing.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that Sony's pushing it, because that makes it a lot more likely to be a mainstream success as well. You know,
so
less
imagine
of a
if, like, whatever
niche
Sony's
thing.
Announcing, you know, it's probably going to be for whatever their devices are or whatever. And it, you know, it's tied to PlayStation brand or whatever. So whatever that thing's going to be, it's going to be Sony's take of it. And that's probably going to be different than what Oculus is doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's already going to be different by virtue of the device it's being hooked up with. The Oculus, if you're going to be on PC, there's a variety of these PCs. You can't count on the PC being fast enough to render to high quality 3D screens and this sort of stuff. So Sony's going to have that console advantage where they'll have some fixed hardware that they're developing this for. So you're going to see some of the probably best quality experiences there, at least consistent experiences there with whatever mm-hmm. they're going to be doing. And then if you look at Oculus, it's going to be more the PC problem, right? Like not everybody has a fast enough PC or this or that or whatever.
But you're going to get really weird experimental experiences there, which is
you
awesome
will. You'll get
right.
all the indie developers making the cool things like that home demo. Where did you see that demo where you've seen some YouTube videos where you're gaming on a big screen TV in your house and you're sitting on the couch and you're playing a game that's on a TV in front of you. And meanwhile, there's all stuff going on in the house around you. Your house is haunted and like you hear creaks and doors opening. You get to look around while you're playing the game, but you can't get up. So like you'll hear like footsteps. You look around like, is there something behind me or whatever? So that's pretty awesome. And it's something that you get to play around with because a lot of these systems have 3D cameras now and all this stuff. So you can imagine like we were talking about with the out of body experience, but what if, you know, you're adventuring around in a game, you come across some display and you're looking at the display and it's showing you in your living room and they insert something into the living room with you there. Like you get to have this like fourth wall kind of moment where you can insert something freaky into your real world and probably force you to take this device off and look just to be sure or whatever. You can do all kinds of stuff with that. And the other thing too is the captive audience thing. When you're wearing this headset, you can be doing 3D chats with your friends and be in the room with them or they can be with you. Or you can have a game where you're both experiencing something very differently. So you can have a psychological kind of game where one person is seeing the world differently than you do. Like they might be going through a door here, but from the other person's perspective, it looks like that person just went through a wall. And then somebody can look through a glass and see a monster in the room with you, but you don't see one where you are, and you're able to talk to each other about it. You could have so much fun with that you just can't do on a standard game.
Yeah, so this is it. This is like completely different genres of gaming could emerge from this, like we saw in the mid-90s. And that's so exciting.
It is. This is going to be you see I'm getting excited about it, but I really feel we're on the verge of like the next step for gaming. And also for us retro heads and everything like that, it doesn't take much to recreate an arcade and have you and your friends hang out there and play games with that ambience.
I didn't think about that. Yeah. Yeah, there's even some of the simple ideas are really interesting, like a roller coaster like you were saying or just a virtual arcade. Huh. Okay, cool.
Since Shuhei Yoshida, he's been downloading the podcast lately. If you're thinking about this, he sent me a Twitter thing, and I just want to say one of the things that I also did on my flight was play a lot of TXK and Oculus Rift support or whatever Sony VR headset support for that. That sounds like fun.
Well, that would be so cool.
Man, that game.
I can only imagine. Like, that would be insane having Jeff Minter visuals surrounding your head.
Yeah, it was pretty brutal going into the bathroom and then looking and seeing my eyes all bloodshot because I hadn't shut my eyes in the last hour that I've been playing the game. Man, that game, if you haven't picked it up on the Vita yet and you own a Vita, you are nuts. It is, we talked about it last time, but it's just really good.
What's your score up to now?
I have to look, but I've been. We talked last time that you could start from a later level and it will give you like some points to kind of ease the, you know, restart. Let me pull it up real quick. But the I was kind of against that at the beginning because I felt like it was almost cheating, like starting at the 10th stage. But then I found that it was actually pretty man, it's amazing. I've had my Vita turned off since I got back.
It's essentially your save state. And you get to like go back to that last level that you succeeded at with the same kind of stock you had in lives and score.
I'm at 584,000.
You're just a baby at TXK.
I know. It's hard.
It is hard. I'm almost breaking the 4 million mark. And
you just called Kevin a baby. I like it.
Well, it's hard, and it's one of those things where I feel like I'll die once, and it's when you transition from stage to stage because sometimes at the bottom there'll be like leftovers, like leftover enemies that if you didn't kill you'll fly right into them, and that is what I kind of been having trouble with, but the game starting to make more sense to me, and it's just crazy. Like the extra bonus stages, and you know, being able to in between stages as you fly to the next board, you can like get bonus points, and just like it's such a weird game, man.
You know, there's so many little cool pro tips in that game. Like for instance, when the spike guys come or the bad guys that kind of roll around, grab you and pull you down the web, and you hear that yell. If you hit your super zapper, then you can actually take them out and come back, which a lot of people don't know about. And then there's also the notion that like whenever you get to some of these really hard levels, get up to at least your first two power-ups and let the board get crazy. Don't worry about it, but save your super zapper for that one moment early on. And when you activate it, you'll immediately almost always get the jump right after that. And once you've got the jump, you can pretty much take on any board.
That's the other thing, making sure you get the bonuses every time, because the upgrades, the power-ups.
Do not miss those. Collect them every single time they show up.
Yeah, because if you don't have that jump, and you, like, you're basically screwed. You need to have
that
jump. Did
you recognize the jump sound?
Yeah, it's from Pitfall, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Everybody who's played Pitfall will recognize that sound the minute they press the button.
Yeah, I mean, I was so like, awesome. Oh, I guess who's going to yell at him for using it? So let's see. One thing I also wanted to mention, coming back and then booting up my PlayStation 3 and seeing that I had Tomb Raider and Metro Last Light for free. Like, what is Sony? Stop. What are you doing? Come on. Why are you giving us all this free stuff? Like, this is,
don't they need to eat?
PlayStation Plus, like, it's really bad because I don't need to buy a PlayStation 3 game. I have such a backlog of PS3 stuff, and I'm not feeling like I need to get PS4 or whatever, because I just have all these games that I could be playing. And even on PS Vita, we got Tekken versus Street Fighter, or Street Fighter versus Tekken before I left. And that game is fantastic. That game is a lot of fun to play on the Vita. So I just want to say, if you have this stuff and you don't have PlayStation Plus, what are you doing? It's just a joke.
It's the best service right now, because I'm always, it's like Christmas every month when they announce what they're going to be releasing. And then somebody here was talking about there's rumors of them having a kind of rental system that they're going to announce or whatever too. Like, I have no idea how the mechanics or anything like that would work, and I have no insights in any of the Sony stuff, but like, if that's the case, that's going to change everything too, because why not? Let's play for half the game and decide not to rent it anymore or whatever.
I just hope they get their, they're getting whatever they want out of it. Like, they're getting some, they're making money off it.
Yeah.
Because again, I almost feel bad, because there's these great games like Tomb Raider didn't come out that long ago. And I've been playing a little bit of it, and I not really getting too into it, but the game is beautiful. Like, for a PlayStation 3 game, oh my God. It looks great. And then Metro Last Light, too. I mean, it's Metro. It's good. I just don't have the time to play it.
I'm back.
You're back. Did you buy?
Yeah, I don't know if you knew I was gone, but
no, it's just, we were just talking about TXK and stuff. But Mike, before we let you go, I do want to see if we can get an update, a pre-GDC update on iDARB. What's up?
Yes. So it's going to be, since we last talked, it's turned into something a little bit bigger than I even thought. It's going to be showing every day at GDC at the Microsoft Lobby Bar.
Awesome.
It's going to be 8-player playable. And not only that, it has this cool character editor that we're going to probably surprise people with. But you can go to our website, idarb.com, and create a character. You can print up that code or take a picture of it. And if you show up at GDC, you just have to hold the code up to the Kinect camera, and it just instantly zaps the character into the game. You can play it. And so it's this cool thing where we're going to be, people are making all kinds of characters, and it's got a cool way of getting the character into the game and all that stuff. But it's come together really well in just the last couple weeks. We've got all kinds of different play modes and all stuff in there. It's turned into a really, really fun game. And it's a pixel art style game. It's really simple, but the core of the game is what really makes it magical. So we've had a couple people come in. We've also taken the game over to Double Fine. We had those guys play it. They seem to really like it. And if you're a Double Fine fan, come on by the booth. You can play as some of the biggest Double Fine characters from their games and also. So it's been fun. It's been really crazy. We've got interviews suddenly lined up. We've got all this exposure. We're going to be at the Loft event on Tuesday, which is the ID at Xbox independent developer event. And so that's going to be there being shown off. It's kind of nuts.
Have you announced any platforms for it yet? I mean, obviously PC looks like a platform.
So right now, we don't really have any major official announcements until the show, but I'll just break it right now. Essentially, Xbox One and Windows PCs are what we're going on to. We're going to be an Xbox One exclusive. How long? Also, I have no idea, but like, we are launching with the ID at Xbox group.
Awesome.
And we're going to be one of the first ID at Xbox independent developer games launched for the Xbox One. So it's going to be
crazy. I was wondering, since you were talking about all that, if it was going to be an Xbox One game, and you were talking about the Kinect camera and everything picking you up. So that's awesome, man.
Yeah,
That's like a system seller to me. I know it sounds like I'm just sucking up, but I've been following this game for a while. And
well, like when we last talked, it wasn't on Xbox One, and they sent us a couple Xbox One kits. And Kevin Wilson, one of our engineers here, who's a genius, brought it over to the Xbox One like almost overnight. And then another genius engineer here, Chris Larkin, who works over here, he was like, what are you going to do about online? And we weren't even thinking about online. We're thinking like couch play or whatever. And we're like, well, what will we do? And then literally like the next day, he's like, it's got it working online. So we have 8 players online playing the game and stuff. So it's just been this really fun experience. It feels like, I think we talked about it before, it just feels like being a kid again, learning how to make games and trying to make games for my friends and all stuff. And we're just putting in what we want to. And the thing about it, too, is on our website, we have a suggestion box. You just go to the bottom and just throw us suggestions. Because the whole purpose of the game was we just want people to see it, play it, and then tell us what they would like it to do. And we just try to include everything. And that's how we got to where we are right now. We've got all these ideas from all over the place. Even when we went to Double Fine, there's all these ideas that came our way, and we've been putting all those in. So it's been great.
The great thing that you did, what I saw you post on Twitter, I think it was yesterday, having that character creator online, making it a lot easier to do on obviously online than having to create the character on the console, because you have mouse controls and things like that, and it's a lot easier to go through the big palette. Mm-hmm. I just thought that that's an interesting idea and a great use of Kinect to be able to do those whatever QR codes or whatever they are to scan that stuff in.
The real kind of like moment for us was like, okay, the situation is you might go over to some friend's house and you guys are your team and they have their team, and you got to always trade the characters where. But what if like you just took your QR code and made a T-shirt out of it? So no matter what tournament you go to or whatever, you just all line up in front of the camera and just put your team right in the game.
Yeah.
And everything. So it's like, and we can also like see what the character makeup is based off of that and everything, put in character data. So if you've been growing the character and stuff, we could track all that. So it'd be really cool. Like you just have to stand in front of the game and next thing you know, all your characters are there and now you're playing. It's a cool,
so cool.
And it's trick. Just like that. You just put the code up and it just like that, your character's there.
It's instant. It makes this little like camera sound to let you know it grabbed it, and you see your character suddenly appear in the game. You're like, awesome. What?
And for listeners who don't know what this game is, I've been following you on Twitter for a long time, Mike. And so I've kind of followed it through that. And it sort of evolved. I think like one of the latest descriptions I read was it's like basketball mixed with there's like goalies, right? Or you're trying to throw a ball into a goal at some point.
So you have a ball now. Like it didn't for a while. Now you have a ball. And so now it's turned into Smash Brothers with basketball style rules. Jeez. With a little bit of Bomberman and a little bit of NHL 94 thrown in for the multiplayer flavors. And it's just got that kind of tug of war going on. It's like, it's hard to say that because it sounds like I'm just making it up, but like it really did come from a lot of those things, and it feels like those games all mashed together, and it's really fun. I knew we were onto something when pretty much every day here at the office people are just like, is it iDarb time? Can we play? And it's like, awesome.
That is good. It. And it's 2D.
2D.
For those who haven't seen it, really cool looking.
With Oculus
you guys
Rift
have a
support.
Bunch of stuff on the website for it, though, I assume, right? On iDarb.com.
Yeah, like yesterday, it was one of these things where we got all these incredible opportunities. Microsoft was awesome, like really wanted to help us push the game and really believed in it. So like suddenly we started getting all these requests, like we want this, we need B-roll footage, we need all this stuff. So it dawned on us, like, we need a website and we need like a Facebook page and we need all this stuff that everybody else normally would have already. So we spent the entire day just like going in the morning having nothing to, by night having an editor online for the characters and a website and all this other stuff, and a build that we could deliver for the show in time and stuff. Like, we had no way to capture 1080p video either. So Tim Rogers, who's from Insert Coin and does the podcast over there, those guys, they're local. So we just kind of like, we knew they probably had the equipment. So we asked, and he just showed up instantly with his MacBook and everything already set up to capture and stuff. So it's just been this awesome experience. And the best part being a lot of our developer friends are just like rooting for us and coming in and helping us solve a lot of the problems we have with it.
Cool. Kevin, you were asking him a question that I also wanted to know the answer to.
No, I'm using the character creator right now.
Okay, and you were asking him about Oculus Rift, but it kind of fell to the wayside.
No, I was kind of half joking.
Yeah, I know it's a joke, but there still might be a way. So I'm curious.
There is a way. So I've seen some demos. When I talk on the show, I'm like, what can I say and what can't I say? But I've seen some demos that take some really well known 2D games and put Oculus support in, and do it in a way that isn't just to do it. And some of those techniques that they were using for those games, I could totally see working for iDARB. So the irony is, it'd be like, how would you even approach it and what's coming? But there's ways you could actually make that experience really cool. Part of it being like, what's behind you when you're playing that game, and what can you give a player by looking back that's information that they would only have because they looked back on their own camera and they were able to look back at the screen and all that stuff. Like, instead of like looking up to see what time it is in your room and getting information on time, like, what other information could you provide that only you would have in your headset when playing a 2D game and that sort of thing, and giving yourself like a box of screens versus one screen and stuff like that. So there's ways to make it very cool.
This thing is so easy to use. It's like, because I'm a terrible artist. I'm a horrible artist. Like, that was my worst class in school. But being able to create a guy with a crown and it looks like he has like a sword on his back took like 3 seconds.
Take a picture of the QR code and send it to me, and I'll put it in the game when it launches.
What?
Yeah, do it. I'll do back in my play team.
All right, we should make ourselves in the game.
They will be an officially launched team for iDARB. Let's do it.
Thank you.
Oh my god.
Done. Yeah, I'm working on mine right now, actually.
All right, then I'm gonna make it even better. I'm gonna redo it.
You're gonna add two colors.
Yeah. Well, I had purple, blue, gray, and red. I'm not an artist, but that's super exciting. It's super cool. And again, these are the kind of games that I get excited about these days. So, and it's great to hear Microsoft going out and, you know, getting the indies to get some stuff on the platform. They got some great criticism about that when they launched, and it's awesome to hear they're listening, and they're going to have a huge component of it at GDC. I can't wait to see the coverage next week.
I think it surprises a lot of people because they just came out of nowhere, and all the stuff you'd always kind of assume about Microsoft and their stance on independent game development from documentaries and everything like that,
yeah,
it's been the complete opposite in this experience. Like, they're very they're very like progressive on getting like everything you need. They're changing policy every day.
Great.
Because the kind of stuff that we do as an indie developer is like, we'll create prototypes, we want to release those and all that stuff. That's something Microsoft's never done before. So when it comes time to talk about that kind of process, they're like, we don't have a process for that, but it'll be in place by the time you need it. And it's like, great, that's awesome.
Awesome to hear. Can't wait. Again, it's the stuff that I'm going to be playing on my next gen console. So all right, so I think we are like at 2 hours and 30 minutes.
mega cast.
So, yeah, let's we'll wrap it up there. But again, I said it before, but Mike, I think this is going to be a case where I'm going to be hitting you up again down the road to do some more stuff, talk about some more games. And we got some great feedback from the interview last time. So,
oh, great.
I think it is something that we're going to need to do again, but thank you so much for coming on. It's again been a huge pleasure, and we couldn't have a better person to talk about the Neo Geo Pocket Color.
Agreed.
Thanks. You guys are awesome. This has been really fun. And I always jump in on these things. I'm like, I hope they want me back afterwards, 'cause this is too fun.
Hell yeah. No, this is what, I mean, I wouldn't do the show, and Josh wouldn't do the show if we didn't love doing it and if we weren't passionate about it. So this is the kind of show that, you know, people who like games, I hope they enjoy too, because you should be enthusiastic about you know, this stuff. Otherwise, find something else to do.
Exactly.
So let's do this. For everyone out there that's been listening to the show, we're hopefully going to be back next week. I can't guarantee it. I'm going to try to get some stuff rolling as soon as possible in terms of games. I definitely have Metal Storm is a game that I've been talking to Josh. We need to cover.
I have it now, by the way.
Holy crap. Yeah, that game's not cheap, but good. Thank you. and also Super Metroid, people have been kind of saying a lot to hit on. So we'll be doing probably Nintendo stuff next time. And to support the show, please, I know I say this, but please do it. Please go to iTunes. Like, that's how we get the word out on the show. That's how you get bumped up in the ratings and spread the word. Because again, it's one of those things where it is a lot more fun to know that people are actually listening to the show and that people are getting stuff out of this. So I'm not going to say, I beg, but I really request that you go to iTunes, submit a review on there. We're also on Stitcher, and we're on the Microsoft Podcast Marketplace too. If you could submit a review on any of those, and also give us your feedback, go to backinmyplay.com. There's a submission form on there where you can let me know what you think. You can put comments in the show notes. I read all those and we accept all of them, so you can post on there. But again, I think that's all for me. Again, we are not retiring the show. I apologize for that missed tweet, and we will be back and going on strong. I hope we continue to be from like what people have been saying on NeoGAF and stuff like that. We have been a positive podcast to listen to, and you know, been one of the top in your iTunes or your podcast list. So thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much for all that. We're going to be back soon. And again, Mike, thank you. Josh, thank you. And again, I'll mention it one more time because you guys are great, the audience. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Head to backinmyplay.com. And that's it for me.
And idarb.com.
Thank you. Yeah, idarb.
That was awesome.
Yeah, can't wait to see what see the coverage for next week. So, again, thanks, everyone. We will see you next time. Take care.
Take care.
Bye.